Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Another one of those Friday afternoons in what should be mid-spring here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia, when Agnes had to do everything short of chasing me into the studio with a ball bat. It's exquisite here. It is beautiful here. It is hot and the sun is warm and wonderful. Oh, it's going to be, it may be a struggle to keep my hand out of the icebox and away from that cold bottle of Corona. But we'll get through. Yes, we will, because it is the end of the working week. For me, it is, well, it's sort of a grieving day, because that means I've got 2 days of enforced silence before we talk again. No, oh my God, I'm on the road next week. We will not talk again until Wednesday evening. I have meetings I have to attend down in Kentucky on Monday and Tuesday, but we'll be back on Wednesday. So it was necessary that I absolutely be here this evening, because this has been a squirreled up week as it was. No show on Monday, technical difficulties on Wednesday. So that gives us Tuesday and Thursday together, and we had to round out the week with this Friday on the front porch on the horn. I am, of course, Bob Kincaid, and it is, it's beautiful here. I know, talking about the weather on the radio. Someday I'll learn. But, you know, this is one of those days that was made for that little-known poem by Robert Frost, where he says, "Oh, stormy, stormy world, the days in which you were not swirled in mist and cloud are so very few. I cannot wonder whence I get the lasting sense of so much warmth and light. It may be altogether from one day's perfect weather, when starting clear at dawn, the day swept clearly on to finish clear at eve." A poem entitled "Happiness Makes Up in Height for What It Lacks in Length." And this is a beautiful day, and it was a touching day. Agnes and I got up at 5 a.m. That's probably why I sound like I have gargled razor blades. Just been up too long, too little fluids, hot, 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 hot. And yeah, my sinuses have been concreted in with pollen. Somebody turned me upside down earlier in the day and just poured pollen in my sinuses, and it's like, so my apologies for that. But yeah, it's beautiful. It is exquisite here. And it was beautiful in Charleston today, too. I only got in behind the microphone a matter of minutes ago, having sort of kept up the news with the news by browsing on my cell phone all day long. We have a new addition to that very select group of West Virginians known as Knights and Ladies of the Golden Horseshoe. Now, that may seem sound silly and insignificant to people far, far away from the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia. But in this state, it's significant. It is the oldest, the Golden Horseshoe test is the oldest test of geographic, historical, and cultural knowledge of one's native state of any such in the country. Now, having been begun back in 1929 or 1931 or so, and based upon an expedition, a merry expedition, mind you, mounted. Now, doggone it, if I... See what you people have done to my mind? You make me have to think dirty so that I can keep up with the dirty thoughts that... Virginia Governor George Spotswood mounted an expedition out of the Piedmont area of Virginia, or whatever they call it over there in the Oldie Dominion, and across the Blue Ridge, looking for settlement possibilities, in other words, Indian land to steal. And they had a right good old time doing it in 1716. And when they returned, Governor Spotswood, colonial Governor Spotswood, rewarded each of the 50 participants in that expedition with a golden horseshoe to memorialize the event. And, of course, where he was headed, where he explored ultimately, was within the territorial confines of what we now know as West Virginia. And so the award given for passing that test is the Golden Horseshoe Award and membership in that merry band. There are, since 1931, some 15,000 recipients of the award out of literally millions who have gone through eighth grade in the state of West Virginia. And my son is now a part of that group. His knighting ceremony was today. I'd love to show you all a picture in the chat room and on the website, but we were told, do not take photographs. We have to wait for them for the professional photograph of the dubbing sword being laid upon his noble shoulder to be mailed to us, at which point I will, by God, put it up on the website. I'm proud of it. I'm proud of the young man. I'm very proud of him. It is in the nature of fathers to be proud of sons, and I am no different, at least when sons do noteworthy accomplishments. He is the first winner of the Golden Horseshoe in his family, and hopefully it will go on. He will go on to bigger and better things. At least that's sort of the point of all the getting up at 5 a.m. and everything that goes with raising kids. His baby sister is now dedicated to the proposition that she, too, shall have a golden horseshoe. Because anything he can do, she can do better. She can do anything better than him, as the old lyric goes. So that's just a little slice of life from the annals of Family Kincaid. And I, that explains, you know, I've been, look, that's the other thing. I've been down to the Kanawha Valley. Anytime I go to the Kanawha Valley, I come back like this. Because the Kanawha Valley has all kinds of poisons blowing through it. From the vast and seemingly limitless number of repositories of poison that reside in the Kanawha Valley. Remember, Union Carbide, nor anyone else, makes methyl isocyanate in Bhopal, India anymore. It is okay, however, to continue to manufacture it in the Kanawha Valley of West Virginia, because, after all, hillbillies are expendable. So there you go. Governor Joe Manchin showed up and delivered a congratulatory address to the newly minted knights and ladies of the Golden Horseshoe today. And when you hear him speak, Governor Manchin is a genial, affable, likable guy. That's why he won an election for governor, after trying on numerous occasions and being whipped in one primary by a decidedly liberal woman. That was 1996, and after the whipping he took in the primary, despite having tried to smear her as trying to teach first graders about how to have sex. No, he did that. He formed an organization called Democrats for Underwood and managed to succeed in beating Charlotte Pritt in the general election so that in 1996, when the nation reelected Bill Clinton, West Virginia, in turn, was saddled with a tired, sad, old alcoholic bag of bones who was ceremonially propped in the corner of state government like something from an Irish wake for the next 4 years. That's how it goes. But Joe is an affable and genial guy. Nice guy. If you want to apply the old George W. Bush standard of would you have a beer with this guy, I've had a beer with that guy. And he is a joy to hang out with. And he's all pro-business, and when he first took office, he had this new slogan, Welcome to West Virginia, open for business. Never mind wild, wonderful West Virginia, which, to the extent that anyone in this nation acknowledges our existence, we were known for. No, it was West Virginia, open for business. After Upper Big Branch, we see the meaning of the slogan. But Joe had a lot to say about education and how we're going to edumacate ourselves here in the hills. And he had laudatory words to say. You know, lo and behold, talking to eighth graders, the eighth graders with their future literally blossoming before them, especially this group of eighth graders, talking to them and taking time to tell them about the nobility of coal mining? Excuse me? And at one point saying something about how patriotic it is to be a West Virginian because West Virginians built America with West Virginia coal and we fueled the Industrial Revolution, all of which is true. But he sort of glossed over the fact that that fueling of the American Industrial Revolution came at a tremendous cost that we still pay to this day. And I beg you to remember, there was some guy, and he's sort of an environmentalist type, but he's one of those national greens who tweeted yesterday. The guy's name is Glenn Hurwitz, and he tweeted yesterday, why are enviros still sending emails about coal mining when they should be focusing all their attentions on oilpocalypse? And suffice to say, I got a little hot. I saw that my buddy J.W. Randolph from Appalachian Voices, who's up in Washington, D.C., trying to advance H.R. 1310, the Clean Water Protection Act, and S-696, the Appalachian Restoration Act, that would bring an end to mountaintop removal in Appalachia. I noticed that J.W. was responding to this guy. And you know me, I always espouse the ancient rule of conflict known as, you hold him down, I'll kick him in the ribs. And I started tweeting back at Glenn Hurwitz as well, explaining that we're still talking about coal mining because coal mining kills hillbillies, and some of us hillbillies are damn sick and tired of it. That 24,000 non-hillbillies, 24,000 innocents per year in the United States still die because we insist on burning an 18th century fuel in the 21st. That's not my statistic. That's not some group of liberal statistics. That's the American Lung Association. 24,000 of your fellow Americans, half of Vietnam, will die every year because we insist on continuing to burn coal in the United States in the 21st century. Got it? Sure, you do. So when Joe Manchin decided to take a few moments of his address to the newly minted Golden Horseshoe recipients, six of whom were persons of color. Got to work on that. That does not bode well. But anyway, when he decided to bring up coal and talk about our proud heritage of building the Industrial Revolution, and Joe doesn't have a big accent like that. I'm being unfair. I wiggled in my seat just a little bit, and Agnes put her little, I was sitting to her left, and she put her little left hand on my thigh and just sort of patted with a sort of increasing sense of urgency. It was sort of a personal married couple's Morse code for, you dumbass, if you get out of your seat and say anything, I'm divorcing you, and you can't afford the child support. Believe me, it was all said in just a series of tap, 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 tap on Bob's little thigh. But Joe did. He told me, you know, nobility of, and, you know, never a mention of the fact that in 2010, we still got 1,000 people a year, many of whom are West Virginians, dropping dead from black lung disease. Something that we've known about for 80, 90, 100 years, and still haven't quite gotten around to figuring out how to prevent, because just as it was in the anthracite coal fields of Pennsylvania in the 19th century, in many senses, an Irishman is still cheaper than a mule. For yea, verily, of those of that bunch that was not the six persons of color, there were a smattering of Italian names, maybe a couple of Eastern European names. But baby, the thing looked like the Scots-Irish Appreciation Society. I mean, Kincaids, Welches, Tylers, oh this and Mick that. Oh, yeah. And so Joe Manchin sits and he finally says, and it is necessary that we have a strong coal industry in this state until we get the fuel of the future. 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 Sure. 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 Because that's the way I heard it. Fuel of the future. Sure. 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 And the grainy, in my mind, the grainy film from some 1950s demonstration video began playing, and there was a woman in an A-line skirt and a man with a pipe, a straight pipe clenched in his teeth, and a fedora hat that he took off when he came in the door, and the Beeve and Wally came to greet him good evening. Someday we'll discover the fuel of the future. Chur, chur, chur. And at that point, with that loving the spousal tattoo still tapping out on my right thigh, I just sort of put my forehead in the palm of my right hand, feeling the onrush of Excedrin headache number Avogadro's damn number plus 6,512. As fuel of the future, sure, ran through my skull. It is not always easy for me to maintain the calm and composed demeanor for which on this program you have come to count on me. Not at all. Because every molecule in my entire being wanted me, propelling me literally from the soles of my feet upward to stand up and say, God damn it, Joe, the fuel of the future, chur, 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 is here because so is the future, chur, chur, chur. It's called wind, Joe. It's called solar, Joe. And we can have it. We can have it all. There are massive explosions on the sun billions of miles away. But they are confined to the sun. And the worst the sun does to us is to give pale little Scots-Irish people like me a nasty sunburn and perhaps the occasional melanoma that has to be carved out of our northern latitudinous hides. Joe, the future, sure, is now. Where are the solar panels in the Coal River Valley, Joe? Where is your support for the Coal River Wind Project, Joe? By God, these scions of hard-working Scots-Irish and Eastern European and African-American and Italian like you, Joe, they didn't get here because their parents were happy little Keebler elves delving under the earth, bringing back the noble lumps of coal. They're here because many of their forebears were damned well slaves, like my granddaddy and my great-granddaddy, who didn't even get paid in real money. Back before your folks even hit these shores. Didn't get paid in real money, couldn't go where they wanted when they wanted. Lived in the house that the boss man told them to live in, Joe. No, they were not happy little Keebler elves. They were slaves to the Industrial Revolution. And though you drape their coffins with flag-bunting, festooning, it doesn't change the fact that they were slaves. And it's 2010, Joe, and slavery is done, and we're sick of it, and we want the freedom that the wind and the sun will bring. And we want it yesterday. Why isn't West Virginia open to business? Open for business. To the sun and the cleansing wind. Fossil fuels will be the end of all of us if we do not get off this habit. As Kate noted to me in an email earlier this evening, talking about the Gulf of Mexico, she said, the bigger picture is too huge for me to contemplate because my denial mechanism has never worked. Species extinction, oil laying in the streams and rivers and bayous for 100 years. Sea mammals suffocating or passing out from the fumes and drowning, and even worse, if the slick gets blown over into the loop, making its way around Florida and into the Gulf Stream. Adios to the palm trees on the coast of Devon. No one is talking about the devastation in Mississippi. Thousands remain homeless. A friend waiting for FEMA or the state to call her agency to move in for recovery for the elderly and disabled. And so we contemplate thanks to people with a 19th century mindset, we are left wondering whether we will ever hear the glories and see the majesty of the 21st. In some ways, it feels like what we in the United States once imagined it must have been like to be a citizen of the Soviet Union. Because back in the days of the Soviet Union, we all imagined that all the Soviet citizens never really heard about the wonderful, magnificent capitalist wonderland we all lived in here west of the Iron Curtain. Why, we had new refrigerators every couple of years, working people buying new automobiles every 5. Functioning public schools, public commons areas that were beautiful and clipped and well-kept and green. Oh, we had it all. Purple mountains' majesties, sparkling rivers, and the crashing, foaming tides of vast oceans cresting upon our shores. And we knew they didn't know that we had this all, and we knew that we knew what they didn't have, and they didn't know that either. It feels a little bit like that now because the green energy revolution is blossoming all over the world. The only place it isn't is here. German-made and Chinese-made and Spanish-made wind turbines are popping up here and there in the United States, but not in Appalachia. The happy little Keebler elves, or the ninth generation sons and daughters of them, simply sit and wait and are taught a West Virginia history that tells them next to nothing about the slavery through which their forebears struggled and fought for a day to dawn that would be, well, I don't know what it would be like because it still hasn't come. Simply put, I do not. Because it isn't here. Because the wind turbines are not turning on top of Coal River Mountain. Because we do not have a national or at least regional plan to put solar panels on every rooftop and slowly pull away from the demonic grasp of the coal-fired energy industry. That day has not come. That beautiful day when the eighth and ninth generation scions of the happy little Keebler elves who delved for coal and came up dead. That happy day has not come. It has not come. So yet I remain hopeful. Because one child out of 225, one child, when the group picture comes out in the Charleston Gazette tomorrow morning, if you look at wvgazette.com, two or three rows down from the top, maybe you'll see, I doubt you will, but that you would otherwise find that one child out of those 225 wore a button on his lapel that read simply, I love mountains. No others. But out of that group of 225, one did. And because one did, this nigh 50-year-old, eighth-generation hillbilly has hope that Appalachia will yet see both the dawning and the promise of the 21st century. Chime in if you wish. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. It's Friday on the front porch, and we won't be talking till Wednesday again. So do not keep your light under no bushel. This is The Horn. This is the repository of hillbilly dreams and hard work and willingness to make a hillbilly future. Yes, this is Activist Radio. This is The Horn.
Looks bright on that tree.
remember the video to that song. And I want to do another one. I just wish I had the ability to do claymation or the animation or some such as that, because I'd love to do a video to Donald Fagan's. Why is it Walter Fagan? Why did I do that? To Donald Fagan's IGY with this vision of little coal black crusted Keebler elves crawling out of the darkness to dance merrily in the sunlight of a beautiful world. Yeah. It is Friday on the front porch. It is 25 minutes before 7 o'clock here in the Eastern time zone, and on this sweet little blue-green orb hurtling through the solar system, the universe and time itself. God only knows what time it is where you are, but it is, regardless of where you are or when you are, time to go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
You sure still ain't prayer meeting night, sir?
Well, you know, not really, Brother Luke, but close enough.
Oh, I tell you what, this has been the week. I tell you what, I figure that most of the winged up looks like they're beginning to totally lose their minds.
They are.
Not that it'll be hard to tell the difference, but still.
I don't know if you noticed this, but the Caribou Barbie has apparently gone completely off her tether.
Yeah, apparently she's even ticked off the people at Facebook.
Well, not just that. She has openly called for American law to use the Bible as the basis for our law.
Oh, yeah.
Mussolini has called for the formation of an official theocracy just like Iran's, only with Jeebus.
Oh, gosh. Does she want to be made pope or what?
I don't know if you can spell it.
This too is true. No, but the ones I was noticing this week is, let's see, first of all, we saw the OxyContin kid went crazy trying to claim that Shahzad was a Democrat.
Missed it. Do tell.
Gee.
Dish.
It's sort of like, you think the people up where he lived at the election commission won't answer the phone rush? You know, like I say, I can sit there and go, that takes about 5 minutes to check that one out real quick. Thank you kindly. I see that somebody rolled over the rock and Brownie showed up.
Yeah, that's.
I'm sitting there going, the only thing reason to have him on is an expert on screwing up. That's his expertise.
Paranoia was, there was more than oil in the water. There was a boatload of paranoia and Brownie out there. But, you know, they were only doing things I predicted that they would do.
Wow. I say, it's hard to see. They must have focused it out, but you couldn't see that tinfoil hat on his head. But, boy, it was on there. And his other one were, Obama waited 10 days to go out there. It's like, you dummies, the first 2 days it was called a rescue operation. And the whole time, that if you remember and go back and look at the tapes, that whole time, apparently BP was telling them there's no problem. You know, the rig's blown up, but there's nothing going on downstairs. You know, it's like, they were caught off a day because they actually trusted the people who were there saying, oh, there's nothing wrong, nothing wrong. You know, please excuse all that stuff you see in the water. That's nothing. No.
Yeah, right. That's
we dropped chocolate syrup. A whole lot of chocolate syrup was on board.
Right, and that of course was what Gene Taylor, Dino, Democrat from Mississippi, was dutifully dispatched to tell the world. It's just like chocolate milk in the water.
That's what I thought of when I said that. I said, okay, it's all chocolate syrup. Ooh. And you notice that the fact that nobody in the mainstream media is mentioning the whole fact that this whole thing, if you get underneath the BP, guess what company pops to the surface? Halliburton.
Yeah, isn't it funny? The same people who brought you electrocuted American soldiers now bring you improperly installed concrete.
Well, apparently this ain't their first time either, because apparently they've had this happen, I think it was over in Japan a couple of times. Where amazingly enough, as soon as they get done, all of a sudden something would blow up. It's like, guys, how many times does something have to blow up before you figure out we're doing something wrong here? Oh, God. And then the one on the bomber, I'm sitting there going, oh, he's a terrorist. It's like, well, good, then you got a whole country load, because I tell you what they said he had in his car, you or I, and you and I both know, we could go out here and take about 3 hours and we could put that same thing together in our car. You know, I can go get me 3 or 4 butane tanks and a couple of 5-gallon cans of gas.
Don't forget the couple of bags of Scott's Turf Builder.
Oh, yeah.
Because he wasn't... You know, there's something, and curiously enough, the be very, very afraid now media haven't caught on to this. Dude was incompetent.
Oh, yeah.
If this is, if then, and out, frankly, if I was the Taliban, I wouldn't be taking credit for this.
Well, and the thing was that...
Because so far, we've now got a list that includes, Luke, a shoe bomber, an underwear bomber, and a turf builder bomber.
I know. What?
Competence ain't their long suit.
Well, the thing that flagged to me was the thing you didn't hear. You know, normally when you hear this, you find them where they put bags of nails or BB shot or something in there that's going to hurt people. This thing would have made a big fireball, but that's about it. Apparently, there wasn't nothing in there to blow out, you know, I mean, and hurt people. I mean, if you're right close to it, of course it would have hurt, killed people, but you know what I mean.
But the trick with car bombing, really, if I may say, and I'm no expert, but it strikes me that the trick with car bombing, Luke, is not to have it smoke first.
No. Well, it's sort of like...
Because at that point, it really does become a smoking gun.
Well, it's sort of like the first thing you think that they would have done was went back and maybe opened the valves on the butane tank, just for a thought. Or maybe took the caps off the gas cans.
I mean, it's like building a car bomb with a case of Bic lighters in the back.
And you put them inside of a lockbox just to be safe, though they didn't get stolen. You know. Oh.
Yeah, and of course, the for-profit media also can't seem to catch up with the fact that the guy who turned him in...
Is a Muslim.
Is a Muslim. But see, that doesn't work with the scary, scary, spooky Muslim narrative that the for-profit media is out there shucking and jiving for all they're worth.
Get our script. We need a rewrite. Come on, we got to cross that out. No, we can't mention that. He's a immigrant. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Immigrant. Scary immigrant. Very scary immigrant.
Well, I'm surprised. I'm surprised that Tom Tancreepy ain't shown up to ask to see his papers yet. But still.
Thank God he's not in Arizona. They would have arrested him before he could have turned in the bomber.
I know. Well, and the thing of it is now, and I don't blame people on this down on the Gulf Coast, but isn't it amazing how the same people who are screaming we hate big government are the ones standing there going, we need the government to come in and help us on this?
Yeah, right.
It's like, I'm sorry, that part doesn't work anymore.
No, their hypocrisy, Gene, is completely...
Overdeveloped.
No, crippled.
Oh.
No, they because, you know, whether it's Governor Bob Riley, who wants, you know, the evil socialist communist to pay for the National Guard troops in Alabama, or David Vitter. Did you see his tweet today?
Oh, no. What was Diaper Boy up?
Diaper Dave is pissed, Luke.
What happened?
Well, Diaper Dave has decided that Mississippi and Alabama and Florida's Gulf coastlines are getting more than their fair share of booms. And that Louisiana is getting stiffed.
Well, you know, I hate to tell Diaper Dave this, but if you look at it, and don't get me wrong, I know there's going to be a lot of damage to Louisiana, but Dave, the coastline and the current is going east.
Well, but beyond that, I mean, there's that. But beyond that, Luke, there's the question of, gee, Diaper Dave, why don't you ask your buddies in the capitalist, Randian, predatory private sector for some booms? Why are you bitching at the Coast Guard? Because that's socialism.
And it's like, if you were going to do this, Dave, why weren't you all out there trying to get artificial reefs put in that would have protected some of your that would have protected some of your shorelines. You know, some breakwaters or something at least would have slowed it up a little bit, you know. But, oh, no, we can't put that in. That might interfere with shipping, and we can't have that happen. It's like, well, that's good. So I'm sure when somebody finally lights some of this up and it's in the harbor, it's going to be just so much fun to watch the fire and the smoke there. You know, it's one of these things that, like I say, some of this stuff, you're just kind of sitting there going, bzzz.
Can you imagine with the stuff, when they do light it up, can you imagine the toxins in that smoke, Luke?
No, I don't even want to.
Don't even want to try.
I mean, that's going to be a cornucopia. Oh, God, that's, you know, it's like, what? It'll be more of a question of what's not in the toxin. You know, well, we can't have that. That's not off this planet. That's okay. We'll figure a way to get it in there. Don't worry. You know, it's... You know,
and well, you know, with their big concrete box, that's going to transfer, you know, it's a cofferdam. They're a big concrete box that's going to transfer all the leaking oil up to the waiting tanker ship. Yeah. What are they going to do when that thing blows?
I know. You know, it's one of these things. It's like, guys, before you, from now on, you know, and it's like, say, this is the time for the Dems in the Senate and the House to really push it. You know, we need some regulations, guys, that they have to have at least two, three good ideas of what's going to happen when something screws up, which it's going to do. Because apparently their favorite plan was nothing will ever go wrong. That's our plan. So that way we don't know what's going to happen. You know, I mean, hey, I wish the world were that way.
And you know what? I had planned some remarks for later in the evening and may get to them yet, Luke. But some remarks along the lines of, you know, do you remember the 8 years of the Bush administration? Do you remember when the seal of the presidency's motto was changed to what? Me worry?
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know what? This is one of the things where I would be pushing somebody. I don't know who it has to be, but I would be pushing, saying, you know what, Dick? You know, big time, Dick. We want to see the minutes from those meetings you had with the oil people during the first couple of years. We want to see what you told them you could.
Well, I see a motion on the table from BP for increased drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. I'd like to recognize the motion and tell them that if they want, I know a little firm that does some concrete work, and if you just say the word, and I'll pick up the phone and make the call. And you know, I can't help but think that getting that concrete work done would get the project online a lot more quickly.
But you know, I mean, it's one of those things. It's like, you know, they'll have two, three different things ready to go to seal it off if something happens. You know what I mean? I don't care if they have to. You know, I'd hate to do it, but I mean, I don't care if you have to put shaped charges down there to make it collapse in on itself down on the ocean floor. You know, something down there ought to be set up so you can just push a button and it seals itself off. Sorry, we'll start a new pipe, a new drill place if we have to, but this will seal itself. You know, I mean, there's got to be somebody out there that's got some ideas on this. You know,
and the fact of the matter is, you want to ask all those questions of Five Deaf Dick. Well, Five Deaf Dick just dropped off the all those notes and all those minutes with his pals, the Saudis.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm sure somewhere that somebody was keeping warm, just throwing another stack of the minutes on the fireplace. You know,
I mean, but this is 21st century engineering. We're going to drop, or they have dropped, a 50-foot concrete outhouse upside down.
Yeah.
On the leaking well.
It's like, why don't we just take us out an oil tanker, fill it with concrete, and sink it right there, maybe on top of it. Maybe that'll do it, you know? I mean, you know, you and I know there are certain things, you know, there are things called blowout preventers, some of these other things. It's like, guys, you gotta have some new technology designed for you know, being...
Right, and you know, it was pointed out to me that those blowout preventers, those things aren't necessarily environmental safeguards, Luke. Those are meant to save workers' lives.
Yeah.
Guess what? Didn't work.
No, it's like...
I mean, it lost in all of this, literally lost in all this, is that there are 11 human beings dead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're probably vaporized, you know what I mean? Or they're by now, they're fish food. You know what I mean? They've been out there long enough if the fish could stand it, you know what I mean? They're still alive anywhere around it. But, that, you know, they'd never find those bodies, you know what I mean? Those bodies.
I wonder maybe if BP's hired the same PR firm that Massey hired.
You know, but you know, it's one of those things. It's like, guys, you know, you all have known that these things have happened. I remember, now you can too, one of my favorite films when I was a kid was, do you remember The Hellfighters?
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, that was 40 years ago. I mean, you know, there were companies out there that took care of ones on land, and now you can't tell me that there wasn't some people doing the same kind of thinking when they started going, we're going to drill in the water. You know, I mean, there had to be people saying, we can do something to, you know, close this off when it... If something goes wrong, which we know it's going to happen, but like I say, once you get past that point, it's like it was some kind of a different kind of blowout preventer that they were saying that BP got the group that I can't think what the name of the MMOC or whatever it is that they essentially said, oh no, you don't need that, no, that'll never happen. It's like, well, Sparky, come on up here, we got some work for you to do. We're going to put you in the mini sub, and we're sending you down to take care of this. You're going to go along. You may not do anything. You just sit there, but you're going to go with them. You know, it's like, God.
Yeah, and Lottie in the chat room also brings something up, Luke. Mithra and Godzilla are going to be pissed.
Oh, yeah.
With what we've done to their undersea environment. Godzilla! Oh.
Yes, my favorite. Yes, as we call it, the man in the rubber suit.
Sergeant Carter, I'm going to take my day off and go to one of the Godzilla movies.
Oh, yes. It's one of those things. It's like, guys, they should not be out there. This is just so common sense. It's like, guys, you know, we can't have you all drill unless you all can show me that if worse comes to worse, you can push a button and seal this puppy off, that it won't be a problem. I mean, whatever the top piece of pipe is that goes, you know, flushes to the ground or whatever you want to call it, there ought to be enough charges or whatever on that thing that you can push it and seal that thing off without even thinking about it if you had to. You know, it's just sort of like, well, if the pipe breaks off, we're sure it'll seal itself off. And you go, how? And they go, well, we're sure it will.
But, yeah, also from the chat room, Matt Osborne from OsborneInc.com, noting that Red 8 Air was still alive when the oil firefighters put out Kuwait in 6 months instead of 6 years.
Yeah.
They worked so fast that the emir had to order a well relit to ceremoniously put it out.
I remember that because that's all they did. And, I mean, I'm glad they were there. You know what I mean? Because he'd been doing it. You know, that's who the movie was based on, essentially. But you know what I mean? He'd been doing that for 30 or 40 years. And you've got to think that he had people working under him that are still alive. You know what I mean? But they, you know, I'm sure they had ideas, and some of these people were just going, well, that costs us money.
Right. You know, that's bad for our bottom line.
You know, I still always go back to, it's totally out of left field. I still always remember in the late 90s when they had, was the Gore Commission, where they had the thing where they put up about 20 things to upgrade airplanes. And the airplane people said, no, no one will ever do these things, so why do we need to reinforce the doors to the pilot's cabins? And, you know, that would cost us money. It might cost us upwards of $1 billion or $1.5 billion. You know, how much money have they lost over the last decade? Where if they just spent $1 billion, you know, 9/11 might not have happened. But, of course, it was, like I say, it would have been bad for the bottom line.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, our quarterly profit and loss sheet it'll be down by a half a penny, and our shareholders will not tolerate that kind of behavior, that sort of corporate irresponsibility.
But you know, like I say, it is hindsight, but it's like, guys, this was not saying, you know, we're expecting the Jetsons tech to be here. This was just simple stuff that somebody could do, and I'm sure it's the same thing with this with the oil wells. I mean, they could have easily put.
Yeah. Well, look. I mean, look at this current plan. Wouldn't you love to have been a fly on the wall in the Situation Room when they came up with this one? And I'm not talking about Wolf Blitzer's Situation Room.
No.
What are we going to do about the problem? Well, boys, what I figure we're going to do, we're going to take a 50-foot concrete outhouse, and we're going to lower it on a rope a mile down into the ocean, and we're pretty sure we can hit a spot 20 by 20.
And essentially, all it is...
What could possibly go wrong?
Essentially, it's just a big concrete sleeve to drop down over top of it and then pump it up through the top of it. You're sitting there going, okay, what's your backup plan? They go, there is no backup plan.
Yeah, I mean, look, think of it this way. There are lots of us who are fools, and many of us have occasionally dropped the quarter into the little claw machine over at Chuck E. Cheese's or wherever, and we can't get the little white teddy bear into the little glass box.
Yeah.
But BP's going to hit the target a mile down with tidal currents in the mix as well.
And I love this thing now where they're saying, well, we may not be able to get an energy bill through. It's like, damn it, you can't get an energy bill through now, go home. You ain't worth it. If you can't push an energy bill through with this, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's like saying you couldn't you couldn't eat in a pie factory.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, if, you know, if anybody stands up and says no, you go out, you know, the next Sunday you be on Meet the Press and you sit there and you point at him and say, Mitch McConnell is an idiot who's killing people, you know, and dare him to come on and say no, and then you ask and make him answer questions in public. But I tell you what, I hadn't been listening this week. I'm sorry, we've had some computer problems here at work.
No, well, I've had some computer problems here, and it's been a weird week, but...
What's off Monday and Tuesday?
I'm traveling down to a meeting in Kentucky, and that will have me preoccupied and too far away to do anything. So I'll be back on Wednesday.
I have not, like I said, I haven't been online. I haven't been able to listen. How's David over in Nashville?
He's north of there, so he's okay. But he is a proud son of Nashville itself, and there is much grieving going on. Literally, one of the stories I saw that David sent along, literally millions of dollars of priceless, irreplaceable musical instruments and amplifiers and electronics and stuff stored in what was thought to be a safe location, completely flooded out. Classroom-sized lockers, if you will. And you can put a lot of 56 Les Paul gold tops in one of those.
Oh, God, no. But, you know, I was sitting there and watching.
And, of course, the human toll is just awful.
Oh, yeah. Well, they were sitting there showing I guess it was Gaylord there at the hotel. And, you know, and at first they show the hotel, and you see a little bit of water. And they pull out, and they keep pulling out, and it's like it's sitting in the center of a lake.
See, that place will forever be not Gaylord's to me.
I know.
But Opryland.
I know.
Because, you know, I rode the log ride there, and ate myself sick on carnival food there, and learned at an early age that no amount of peer pressure would ever get me on a roller coaster again there.
I just always remember the Opryland Hotel because you got that big ass radio antenna right across the street from it.
So
that one for the old.
But you know, Mike Malloy touched on this the other night, and it was something that had occurred to me as well. So I sort of left it alone. But the fact of the matter is, John Hagee said that, New Orleans was hit with a hurricane because of the queers, and Pat Robertson said, and Jerry Falwell, who is now perpetual barbecue in hell, said that 9/11 was because of the gays, the lesbians, and the ACLU and People for the American Way and Norman Lear. Under those circumstances, is it too much to do the? There's some pharaonic stuff going on here, some biblical level stuff going on here. Where you remember in the story of the Exodus and everything, where Pharaoh says, "Well, you know, the firstborn male child of yours shall be born," and Moses says, "I'm rubber and you're glue," and it bounces off me and it sticks to you, and we get this Passover story and all of that stuff. Is it possible that maybe these right-wing fundamentalists and these teabaggers have really pissed God off? Because, after all, it was the Gaylord that played host.
Oh, yeah. Could you imagine if that had been what happened, if it had been that weekend? Oh, God. But
David just shot me a note and said 1,200 families are dealing with ruined homes, and that doesn't count the apartment dwellers forced out. Home loss is expected to total 1,500 once the counting's done.
Yeah, because it's still waiting. They're still waiting on a lot of areas still to drain. You know, this is a slow one. It's just taking a while for it to dissipate. I'm assuming they've got all the.
Ain't nothing this nasty come down the Cumberland River since Yankees.
Well, the one that got to me when I got thinking of, if you ever been to Nashville from Knoxville, just where you get into Nashville, there's this big ass dam you passed by. Right outside of Nashville, and I was just sitting there going, God, I bet 10-1 they've had to have the floodgates on that open 24/7 for the last week. It's, I can't remember which one it is, but it's a big one. It's right by the interstate. And you're just like, oh, yeah, thank you. Oh. But, no, like I say, it's my opinion. I still think it's Toby Keith's fault. We'll blame it on him. You know, so. I saw one thing in the entertainment industry that scares me.
Yes, and that is?
Gary Busey has procreated.
Again?
Yes.
Had
a young one, and I'm sitting there going, Busey, no!
That's disturbing. I mean, what was it, Contact, the movie that had him, had his other offspring as the bad guy?
I know. It's like I say, there are some people, I'm sorry, it may not be very very liberal, but there are some people who should just be told, don't reproduce. Sorry, it's like the old things with you remember the old Darwin Award?
Yeah, come on, Gary, we're going to take you to a farm where you can run and play and be free. Come on, get in the car, Gary, get in the car.
But, you know, it's like the old Darwin Award used to be, said, you know, thinning out the herd, you know, getting rid of the stagnant end of the gene pool, please. But I tell you what, bud, it's about top of the hour, so let me let you get on out of here in case you got to do some news and stuff.
All right, you take care, Luke.
All right, you take her easy.
Bye now.
Bye.
Calling from East Tennessee, that's our buddy Luke, and we move onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Oh, pretty good once I get over the Kanawha Valley sinuses.
Well, I hope that will pass very quickly. And congratulations on your son's honor today. That's very important to him, and I hope he'll have many more.
I thank you very kindly. It was very inspiring to him. It really was.
Appropriation. Today is Tchaikovsky's birthday, if anyone's interested.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it is. But moving on to your earlier topic, as far as the coal industry and stuff like that are concerned, and a number of energy sources that we have, you know, I don't understand the opposition by some people to wind farms and things like that, because I've seen those in California, and it's, some people have said they're aesthetically displeasing. And, you know, I think, to tell you the truth, from my standpoint, they're very elegant. They're very beautiful structures.
They are. They are absolutely in both. And, you know, we do have the Dutch as an example who took, their, you know, they needed those wind turbines because they powered the pumps.
Exactly.
That reclaimed the Netherlands from the sea. And then they proceeded to take those same windmills and plant tulips around them and turn them into tourist attractions. But we can't do that because if you ask a Republican, Jim, well, Americans just ain't that sharp no more.
No, I think they're the ones who aren't that sharp anymore. And when you look at what mountaintop removal does to the top of a mountain and look at the aesthetics of that compared to the aesthetics of an elegant windmill farm on top of a mountain, I don't think you have to think very hard to draw a logical conclusion, do you?
Not at all. And then beyond the aesthetics, the poisons that mountaintop removal pumps in pumps into communities that runs downstream to a quarter of this nation. Beyond that, the fact of, you know, what our dependence on fossil fuels in the liquid form is doing to this nation. We may be decades answering questions of what BP Horizon did to us and to our future. There was a graphic that circulated on the internet widely in the last week that showed a wind farm at sea, and Huffington Post picked it up. And the headline was, "Massive wind spill at wind farm. No damage reported, several enjoying light breeze."
Well.
And then, I mean, in a nutshell, isn't that it? You know, because you don't get.
And there you have it.
And, you know, all the explosions associated with solar energy, as I said, are taking place a couple of billion miles away.
Well, the problem with that is, the problem with wind farms and with solar energy and things like that, particularly with solar energy, that's the type of energy that can be generated at home with a device on top of your house.
And therein lies the critical problem because it doesn't fit in with the corporate model.
Regulated and built the way they can build the consumer with nuclear and the coal and things of that nature. And this is another betting wire that I have, and that's nuclear power plants. And it can, may I just talk for a second about those?
Do please.
Well, you know, back in the 70s, I had a bumper sticker on my car that says no nukes, because that's when they were building some type of plant back in, it's right in the southeast, right over the Tuscaloosa aquifer. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Well, those plants and those processing facilities are built to last roughly 25 years, okay? And most of these have long outlived that expectancy. And it costs more to decommission a plant like that than it does to build it. Now, in the area over the Tuscaloosa aquifer is a Class 3 earthquake zone. Now, if you could imagine an earthquake that would knock the bottom out from one of those facilities, what it would do to the water supply of the entire southeast.
Yeah, and consider, exactly, and consider, we were talking about Nashville just a moment ago, or Nashville, properly said. Their water supply is threatened profoundly by flooding. Not by a nuclear, you know, emergency, by flooding, by just elevated water. And the water supply of Nashville is like down to half or less capacity. We don't begin to comprehend, Jim, how fragile is this civilization that we think we have.
Exactly.
Atlanta, Georgia is watered by the Chattahoochee River. I used to live in Atlanta, Georgia. And you could literally wade across the Chattahoochee River in spots and not get your knees wet. And that's what waters Atlanta. And Atlanta is how many millions of people, including its outlying areas? Not a lot.
At least four.
Yeah.
At least four. But, I mean, you know, these people were so short-sighted. And I can remember someone observing that bumper sticker on the back of my car, and they asked me what I had against Nuki.
Oh, Jim.
I'm not kidding. And I said, what are you talking about? Well, Nuki, you know.
Oh, my.
I used the P word, too.
Yeah, but obviously you have wandered among tribes of idiots from time to time in your life.
I was looking at this idiot, and I said, it has to do with nuclear power. Well, what do you got against nuclear power? And I said, what do you know about nuclear power? And, you know, what do you know about the...
And we were off to the races, weren't we?
And I said, how dangerous it is. And I said, you know, what do they do with those spent fuel rods? And how long does it take for those things and the half-life contained therein to go back to a safe, you know, level of normalcy? Well, they didn't know what the hell I was talking about, and I realized that I best be on my way. But, and these spent fuel rods from these nuclear plants, well, it's pointed out that most of the suitcase bombs and the bombs that they're worried about coming into this country causing another nuclear disaster can be manufactured from those spent fuel rods. Now, this is in Afghanistan, and this is in the central steps of what was the former Soviet Union, not here. And I think DOE probably has better control over that than those people over there. But there have been many cases documented, or at least one that I know of, where a truck filled with spent nuclear fuel rods has gotten over the Kazakhstan border and has gotten into the hands of Iran and people who would like to build a nuclear bomb, because you can take those spent nuclear fuel rods and you can further enrich it into either a dirty bomb, which will, of course, blow nuclear stuff all over the place using conventional charge, or they can build a regular, at least 10 kiloton atomic bomb. And that's the cause of great concern right now. And the people over there in Pakistan who are dealing with this say, we have no reassurances. And, of course, the people who are in charge of dismantling these nuclear power plants or these bomb plants Soviet Union had quite active during the Cold War, they still can't guarantee 100% recovery of that fissile material. And, you know, what we're looking at here, in my opinion, whether it's these huge reservoirs of filthy water that's contaminated beyond redemption, or nuclear spent fuel rods being generated into something very terrible, we have a host of miniature Chernobyl.
Yes, we do. And even, I forget who it was that coined the phrase, but with the for-profit media out there trying to advance the notion that what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico is Obama's Katrina, I forget who it was that said, no, it's not, it's Cheney's Chernobyl.
Exactly.
Because all, and perhaps at our peril, Jim, we forget that, as you have noted from time to time, the wheels of justice grind exceeding slow, but also exceeding fine. So, too, American realpolitik lapses behind our electoral changes. And the fact of the matter is, yeah, we are about a year and a half into the Obama administration, but we have not begun to even scratch the surface of the perfidy with which the Bush administration poisoned our body politic.
Exactly.
And this, you know, what BP Horizon is a direct result of energy policies put in place by Dick Cheney. I'm not giving a pass to Barack Obama on this at all, but I'm merely dealing with reality.
I know you are. And speaking of reality, this particular solution of dropping this huge concrete box over this well. Okay, that is a reasonably successful procedure in depths of like 400 to 500 feet. But we're talking about a mile down, and they're trying to drop this thing down there. And one of the problems that they're anticipating is the wreckage of the platform itself, which could surround the well they're trying to cap. Now, I'll tell you, capping a well on the surface and capping a well a mile down beneath the sea are two different things altogether. Now, where they can even attempt to effect some type of seal around this spouting well with that wreckage from the platform around it, they don't know yet. We won't know until tomorrow if they can have even a modicum of success.
And see, that's one of the things that drives me crazy about these goofy little graphics that cable news organizations and the main and you know the over-the-air network organizations are wont to put out. Because I don't know if you've seen them, but I did. I got a passing glance at one that just shows this, you know, concrete outhouse being merrily lowered in what was collapsed to scale a mile under the water, and it just settles perfectly over the spill or over the leaking well.
I don't think it's going to work quite well.
I think there's an oil platform in the way, isn't there?
Yes, there is. I was looking at the Christian Science Monitor this afternoon, and they were pointing out, you know, the possibilities of that wreckage interfering with the integrity of the seal that they're trying to establish. And already enough oil has escaped at that depth to very seriously damage the lower ecosystem.
Well, there is an organization that for years has monitored these sorts of things in the oil and gas industry, as well as the coal industry, and they're out of Martinsburg, West Virginia. And these, I heard an interview with the head man there as we were driving to Charleston this morning. And they're sort of putting, to the extent that anyone's listening, they're putting the rest of the industry on its ear, because they have said that based upon the data that they have been able to gather, that we are all being hoodooed over what's actually going into the Gulf. And they said that their actual per day estimate is not 5,000 barrels or 50,000 barrels or whatever it is. 5,000 barrels times 48,
but 10 times as much.
Yeah, easily 10 times as much as what's being said.
And here's the thing. When you start playing around with the ecosystem at that depth, you're playing around with the very bottom of our entire food chain. It's all tied together by nature. And when you start causing damage that serious, it's going to go up the food chain.
Yeah, I remember it wasn't that long ago that we were that David from Maine called in with the amazing story of the shrimp that waved hello to a camera that had been sunk to Antarctic depths where they were, the scientists were quite certain no life could possibly exist. And, a shrimp came up and waved and said hello.
Exactly.
And
it's like I say, right down there at the bottom of the ocean is, you know, our entire food chain is sort of like Maslow's pyramid. You know, it all goes uphill, so to speak. And it's supported from the bottom up. And what is happening, I am afraid, is we are destroying the bottom tiers of that food chain, and it's going to have impact that's going to last an awfully long time.
It's rather like what it is, and that may be apocryphal, but it's rather like what Einstein is said to have remarked upon about the end of humanity following about 3 years after the end of the honeybee.
Well, and another thing, I don't know what the integrity of that dome is, but can you imagine the pressure?
Right, it's concrete.
On concrete?
And remember, this whole thing may trace back to concrete work done by Halliburton. And I haven't seen any news reports telling me who did the concrete work on the big concrete outhouse.
Well, I haven't either, and I think BP is keeping that very close to their chest, who they outsourced that to.
You want to make any bets?
Not really.
No, me neither.
But, I mean, I just wonder, and how long can something like this last? Now, of course, the secondary plant, if they are able to drop this structure over the well, is to drill another well and seal this one. But it's all almost like some of these science fiction movies in which we have this huge asteroid. Well, how are we going to destroy it? Oh, we'll blow it apart. Well, if they blow the son of a bitch apart, then it's just going to scatter the entire Earth. You know, it's almost like one of these science fiction movies like Apocalypse or whatever the hell those things were in the 90s that you used to see about these big meteorites coming in from out of space and how are we going to destroy them with these nuclear weapons or this, that, and the other. And it sort of sounded like a lose-lose situation.
Well, but we've been far too fascinated with stuff like that, the gee-golly whiz-bang weapons that we're going to use to take out the aliens when we need some sort of rather prosaic answers to problems here on Earth.
Well, I do agree with you there. And, you know, I just don't have I don't mean to be a doubting Thomas, but I don't have a lot of faith in them being able to drop that thing.
Well, nor do I, Jim, because here's one reason I have no faith. Because BP has not figured out a way to make a dollar out of it. And I don't want to sound like somebody hollering, you know, to the barricades, the workers of the world unite, and we're going to queue up the Internationale any minute now. But the fact of the matter is the profit motive, there are times and places on this planet where the profit motive is utterly ill-suited to getting anything meaningful done, and this is one of them.
Well, what I understand is what they want to do, if they're able to emplace this device over the top of that well, then they're going to use a spout on the top of it to still gather the oil.
Because they still want the oil.
That's one of the plans that they have.
Not to be oversimplifying, Jim, but it boils down to this. BP is still trying to figure out a way to make a buck. It's like the four-year-old who knocks over the cookie jar, breaks Mama's antique cookie jar all over the kitchen floor, and Mama's scrambling around so little Junior won't cut his little feet on the broken pottery, and Junior's sitting there screaming, "But I want the cookies!" Even though the cookies are now contaminated potentially with, you know, broken glass.
Exactly. But they still want to try to gather oil from that well by putting some type of pipeline to it that will, in other words, the cofferdam or whatever you want to call it, will allow the oil to funnel up into some type of big long pipe or whatever in which they can still...
That has a tanker on the end of it.
Exactly. And I just wonder, when you are dealing with 5,200 feet of water...
Jim, I watch... I don't know if you've ever seen it, but on the Discovery Channel, I've seen it a couple of times. The guy James and I watched a couple of hours of it one afternoon in Pittsburgh. That Deadliest Catch. You know, we get people killed trying to get crabs off the ocean floor in the Bering Strait. And we think we're going to tether a great big oil-filled umbilicus from an upside-down outhouse with a funnel on it up to a tanker, and that's going to work out just hunky-dory?
It doesn't inspire confidence in me at all.
It doesn't inspire my desire to call and lay a bet with Harris in Reno either.
No, it doesn't. And I think they predict that sometime tomorrow they will know whether or not they were able to or going to be able to emplace this thing properly. And then, even if they emplace it properly, how long is it going to last? What is the life?
Well, you know, there are people out there who understand the rules of force and physics and engineering, and all you need to do is plug in what the pressure is at 5,200 feet below sea level, and plug in the dimensions of the concrete in the concrete upside down outhouse, and you've got an answer. And I'll bet you it's not a good one, because the problem with this is that it's going to collapse, and then you got to. So we not only have to hit the bullseye once, sooner or later we have to hit the bullseye every time.
Well, you know, I think they could talk to Robert Ballard about this, because he's quite familiar with deep sea diving when he found
the Titanic, sure.
Submarines that we'd lost, and that was, you know, when he first went in search of the Titanic, he did so on a Navy grant. But the only way he was able to go to the Titanic was to make a deal with the Navy that he would find the submarine first and the Titanic second. And the Titanic sank in how many miles of water? Was it 2 miles of water?
I think so.
Well, the pressure on the Nautile and Ephraimir and also the Soviet-built submersible, I mean, those pressures are just enormous.
Well, and let's add one more into the equation, Jim. David in Tennessee noting for me. He says, let's say the outhouse hose pipe tanker gambit works. How's an oil tanker going to fare come hurricane season, which we just kind of happen to be in?
Well, exactly.
Because all of this is predicated on buying time to drill that relief well. In other words, we're going to solve our crushable concrete outhouse problem by letting BP drill another well in search of, and don't anybody fool yourself by thinking otherwise, in search of profit replacement, not disaster surcease, but profit replacement. And you know, that's where we've become just a little bit too kissy-faced, just a little bit too footsy between the public and the private sector. When a corporation like BP screws up like this, the answer is to say, you can't do it anymore. Just like Mama would look at Junior and say, we're not going to talk about the cookies right now, son. Mama has to get a new cookie jar, and I'm going to put it out of your reach. Now, Junior may cry, but there won't be any more broken cookie jars.
I mean, you know, when you deal with dangers like this, whether it's coal and the contraindications that go along with its removal and the storage of the poisoned water that's created, or whether you deal with nuclear situations like Chernobyl, for example, I mean, and this oil thing, I would say that what is happening in the Gulf is another type of Chernobyl.
Yes, it is.
And if you go to Chernobyl today, Do you realize that a part of the Ukraine is virtually uninhabitable? And the amount of area that is uninhabitable in the Ukraine is the size of Great Britain.
And that is, yes. And we may well see the beginnings of the same sort of thing along the Gulf Coast.
I'd like to be a survivalist and you know, be very optimistic and things like that. But after seeing so many of these things happen, and when I imagine a rupture of one of these cofferdams around one of these poison water things, killing 1,000 people within an hour here, or what happened in Chernobyl, and how that land will be uninhabitable for, I don't know how long. I don't know what the half-life is of that stuff there. And, you know, I'm sorry. I guess I am what you'd call a desolationist. I don't want to be.
That's a fascinating word coinage. I've not heard anyone use it. But if I understand you correctly, Jim, I too am one. Because I think 1,000 years down the road, and I think about, for instance, whatever replaces us 1,000 years down the road here in Appalachia, and I think of a wandering band of surviving humans, for instance, wandering into what should be absolute happy hunting ground, so to speak.
Right.
And having an entire clan die off because they drank the water that Don Blankenship had poisoned 1,000 years before.
Exactly.
I think like that, and apparently you do too.
I do too, and you know the axiom is stupidity has a habit always of getting its way.
Whew.
I wish I could have.
That's a brutal commentary on the human experience, but I sadly must concur.
Well, as you know, I read a lot, and I try to improve my mind as best I can beyond what I was taught years ago and other training and stuff that I have. And the more I read and the more I understand, the darker the picture becomes.
One of the things, I pulled the State Board of Education superintendent aside today, and I said, listen, I'll never get to speak to you again. But, seeing how the governor said he wanted to really move forward in changing how we educate our children during his speech today, I said, may I suggest that some of those changes should be retrograde motion? And, of course, I used retrograde motion. His eyes rolled back in his head. But I said, listen, we talk about this great nation and how our founders were so, and all the things that this great nation was predicated upon. Well, it was predicated on people who could write and who could read. It was predicated on an educational experience that began with the ability to read Latin and Greek at the same time one could read English. Can you tell me there's a public school, sir, anywhere in West Virginia where a ninth grader, let alone a pre-literate, can begin to learn Latin and Greek? No, sir, I cannot. I said, you've answered all your own questions that you haven't even gotten around to asking.
And in addition to that, they are transmogrifying our own educational system to colorize history, to shape it in their own image, and to take it out of its original context. And as I said before, with succeeding generations, people are becoming dumber and dumber and dumber.
And I would argue, Jim, that that is deliberate.
Of course it is. I mean, we talk about the Soviet Union doing that after the revolution when they rewrote history books. Well, we're doing our share of that, too.
But the Soviet Union, Jim, also advanced its technical learning and produced brilliant engineers who literally made bricks without straw in competition with the United States. Consider the MiG versus American aircraft. Consider their nuclear program versus ours. Consider everything that they had to do without and still do. We're not even doing that here. We are not producing brilliant engineers at the expense of classics scholars. We are simply producing neither.
This is true.
And all one needs in the way of a classical education, Jim, and I suspect you've got a big chunk of that in your own right, knowing as I do what you've mentioned of your upbringing and your education, all one needs do is go back and read the story of the, of how the Romans plowed the earth and salted the ground at Carthage and made that place unlivable and uninhabitable forevermore. And that was just salt. Look what we do with selenium and mercury and arsenic and elements of rocket fuel and hydrocarbons.
Well, what you were speaking about earlier, the thing that happened in Bhopal, India, and they stopped that, but yet they're doing it over in Charleston, correct?
Yes, sir.
Well, good Lord in heaven above, can't they take a lesson from what happened in Bhopal, India, and realize that that could happen right there in the capital of West Virginia? Can they not?
But Jim, you're overlooking something, my friend. They don't care. Hillbillies are every bit as expendable in the grand corporate scheme as some dark-skinned inhabitant of the Indian subcontinent. That is the equation.
You know, Bob, if that's the way people in this country think, who are in the higher-ups and who are willing to take these risks and do things like this, then they have no right, really, to point the finger at some of the stuff that went on in Poland and Russia and occupied Europe during World War II. Because what it is, it boils down to one word. Holocaust. And that's exactly what these people really don't care. They don't want to understand. And, you know, they have their own agenda, which is to promote their own well-good, just as the Nazis had their own thing with eliminating inferior races.
And Lebensraum.
And achieving living space for Lebensraum. I mean, can you tell me, is there any difference?
Well, no, there's not, and all of it points to an arguably correct thesis on the part of the late great Kurt Vonnegut, to wit, that the human race is a virulent virus of which the planet is desperately trying to rid itself.
I'm afraid you're right, my friend. I really do.
Well, Jim, this has been a magnificent conversation, and I wish you a happy weekend.
And the same to you, sir.
All right. Take care, Jim.
All right. Good night.
Good night. And this is kind of what makes the horn all worthwhile to me. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Hey, yeah, no. Cato the Elder was announcing Carthage all the time.
Yeah, Cato, yeah, exactly. Cato the Elder sat in the Senate of Rome. As my old Latin professor said way back in the dim, dark days of my education off in far Missouri, he said, every time the Senate came into session, Cato the Elder would rise from his bench, and in his creaky old voice he would cry, Carthago delenda est, which means Carthage must be destroyed. And he said,
right.
It got to where people would say, hey, Cato the Elder, how you doing? Out in the street, and it's Carthago delenda est. And my Latin professor said, it got to the point where people wouldn't even invite him to parties anymore.
Well, no, but I mean, you know, and it's sort of the mindset, because what they did to that city, state, is shocking. I remember when I first read it, I thought, man, these people, you know, the salting was just the final...
Yeah, but the other thing, Sandra, the other object lesson out of this is that all the difficulties with Carthage arose not out of Carthage's necessarily belligerence, but all of the Punic Wars, and one can never forget the late great Barney Fife, who being inquired upon, Barn, what did you think of the Punic Wars? And Barney said, I was for the Punics. Sorry, just had to go there. But anyway, the Punic Wars were trade wars.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the whole idea that Rome had ascended, they said, no, that's what we have to get rid of. They were okay together for a while until Rome you know, built itself up, became a bigger traitor, then they saw their main enemy, and they had to get rid of him.
Exactly.
So it was definitely predicated on Rome's need to increase its trade routes. They created boats. I mean, they lost hundreds of boats. They didn't give a F. They kept at it until it destroyed that city-state, who was strong, but they didn't even know what the hell they was coming up against with these Romans. The Romans were crazy at that point. Insane.
Well, they had, at that point in time, if I recall my history correctly, they had just gotten their taste of the good stuff, Sandra. Because they had expanded
on the peninsula completely at that time.
For the first time, they had gotten their first real handful of what would later become known as Jed Clampett walking around money. And they had a really good, and by far silver was the coin of the realm, not gold. But they had gotten their first real influx of silver, and their trade network had expanded. And they had the Republic had developed a taste for more. And I think there's an object lesson there that whenever at least pseudo proto democratic institutions start wandering around the globe and getting a little jingling money in their pocket, empire is not far away.
Well, not only that, but then of course that led to the end of the Republic. You know what I mean?
Yes.
The whole idea of the expanding empire, but no, just that city. Yeah, I can believe what. Yeah, well, one of my favorite, if you have to have a favorite, generals is, of course, Hannibal. What the F? He was out of control. And, the Romans had a long memory, you know?
Yeah, I am going mountain climbing with elephants. Now, that takes some brass. And he was a brilliant general, and he whipped them left and right.
Yeah.
And I think our pal Eugene Finnerman would probably say that even in his last great campaign, he beat himself.
Yeah, well, the only problem that Hannibal had was that he assumed that the people would go with him. He underestimated, the people's affinity with their homes. And that was sort of his downfall. You know what I mean? Otherwise, he was sort of kicking ass.
Yeah, he was. And the whole development of those two cultures is fascinating because it's all and really those people who understand that history exists on a continuum, that it's not the broken up with little Jersey barriers here and there, and okay, this is a new, because we talk about eras and we talk about this civilization and that civilization. The ancient Minoans of Crete are thought to have established the colony that later becomes the Phoenicians.
Mm-hmm.
The Phoenicians, in turn, are the ones who established the colony that later became Carthage. Meanwhile, the Romans develop along completely different lines, always at odds. You know, they trace their history through the ancient Greeks. The ancientest of the ancient Greeks are the ones who came and finally wiped out the Minoan culture after the earthquakes and natural disasters had opened the doors on that. Because all the excavations and everything that we know about ancient Crete, those magnificent cities didn't have walls, they didn't have guard towers, they weren't fortified, they were an island protected by the sea. And so it's played out on a greater Mediterranean stage, the constant dynamic tension between the Greeks, who then later more or less fathered the Romans, because, you know, what was going on the Italian peninsula until the Greeks began to set down colonies there was really rather pastoral and prosaic.
Yeah.
And so it was played out over a host of centuries, and it plays out and it plays on down to this day.
Look at, people always talk about globalization, as if it's something new. But, I mean, you've had periods of the same globalization, contraction, war, unfortunately. That's what worries me. You know, you had globalization during the Roman time, and we know what kind of wars went on then. The British sort of kept things contained for a minute, and you had globalization, at the turn of the 19th century, before World War One, And then you had, well, we thought we had, you know, contraction, depression, war. So I'm a big history buff, but I'm not naive to think that technology can protect us from that cycle. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so that's my worry right now, especially looking at...
Well, maybe you are member number three of Jim's newly minted cabal of desolationists.
I don't know. I just think that, you know, this sort of crisis that we're in, I'm sorry, we are not over it, and it just looks like it's just spiraling. And so much of it is just kind of stupidity, because you're going to tell me that a typo caused the stock market to drop?
Oh, see, I was about to go there, Sandra.
No, and if that's the case, you don't want it regulated? Hello?
If that's the case, you don't want it.
And you don't want it at all, but not only that, but hello, could I buy some Tencent Procter & Gamble stock, please, for 10 minutes so I can make be a millionaire in 10 minutes? What the fuck, man? Where's the investigation? I mean, they had stocks dropping to the bottom.
But here's a delightful little moment of paranoia for you. You know that Procter & Gamble has been the bete noire of the right wing for decades now, right? Because if you look down, I think they're still using it. If you look down in the corner, they've got a graphic, an icon, if you will, of it's a circle and it shows a crescent moon and some stars.
Oh, right. You know, I vaguely know what you're talking about. Shut the hell up.
And the weirdo, mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, right-wing freaks have screamed for years that Procter & Gamble is a satanic organization. And lo and behold, before this whole thing went down yesterday, Sandra, out there in the political weirdosphere, bear with me for a moment here, this is going to take a little work. There's a primary, or was a primary, in Ohio. You may have heard about this. And the two Democrats, who were vying for the opportunity to compete against Mean Gene Schmidt, remember Mean Gene?
A
guy named Kerkorian and a guy named Yalamanchili. Mr. Yalamanchili was, of course, brown, of Indian extraction. A couple of weeks back, Kerkorian, Democrat, you know, Democrat doesn't mean you don't also have stupid behind your name. Kerkorian said, well, of course voters should vote for me. That man couldn't possibly win an election with a name like that. Here in 2010, where the president's a guy named Barack Hussein Obama.
Right.
And so then people pick up on the story of this racist freak, Kerkorian or whatever his name is, and begin giving him hell for the bigot that he is. Well, when that happens, Kerkorian shoots back. And he says, this is all made up stuff, and people are, and it's only getting traction because Yalamanchili is being supported by Procter and Gamble. Because Mr. Yalamanchili had worked for Procter and Gamble at one point. Of course, Think Progress went out and called Procter and Gamble, and they said, well, no, we don't pump any money into anybody's political campaigns. We don't do that kind of thing. But that didn't slow down the raging river of paranoia flowing out of Mr. Kerkorian or Kerkorian, whatever the hell his name is. And so, you know, it's one of those things where maybe you can't say, you know, point A to point B, and you certainly can't travel some circuitous route that goes through K and back around to D and loops under to Z. But it struck me as a little bit weird that this thing that happened on Wall Street yesterday is being blamed on the one corporation that right-wingers have decided is evil, and that self-same corporation has found itself in the news for having supported an arguably liberal Democrat of dark skin tone, but they didn't really, but the right wing, you know, facts don't matter. Now you can carry me away in the straitjacket. I've said it.
Well, I mean, no, and it's just sort of, I mean, they mentioned Procter & Gamble and also, you know, sourcing it at Citi. But my thing is that now the SEC is threatening investigation because they're concerned about the weird trading activity that was going on while the fall was happening. You see what I'm saying? You can buy low and make a lot of money, right, because it all bounced back. And people are, you know, the SEC is wondering, was there something illegal going on? I mean, hello?
Wondering.
I mean, it's a joke. It's like, what are you talking about? Are you going to have something drop 1,000 points and stocks, you know, lose 90% of their value, and then you have suspicious buying opportunities? Come on.
I'll take a short position on that.
Well, it's just, and the thing is like, I'm just sort of, you know, and there's no and they want these things to all be self-regulated, from the oil spills to the sugar factory that catches on fire. All of it needs to be self-regulated. Are you kidding?
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
And that thing that I don't know, who was the caller before me?
Jim.
Jim, you know, boy, he broke it all down. But that thing, they're dropping it. I mean, are we really going to believe that? Do you actually believe that shit?
I'm getting further technical advice from David in Tennessee, who has, you know, a little bit of understanding along these lines. And, you know, as he pointed out, what happens when the tanker that's attached to that umbilicus has a hurricane roll over it? And so I asked a couple of questions, and he said the usual safety factor for keeping an anchor in place on a ship is 2 times as much as the distance to the ocean floor. So if this thing's going 52, if the garden hose going down to the concrete outhouse is 5,200 feet, then it by definition has to be 10,400 just to deal with tide, current, the swells, waves, whatever.
Well, I just don't believe it. And after reading this whole article about how it's really 50,000 barrels coming out, not 5.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just sort of, I'm in a state of shock. I don't believe BP because I know they was trying to pay people $5,000 to shut the F up. So I start from that point. If they're so concerned, why the hell are they trying to pay fishermen off with $5,000?
Yeah, especially as compared to what that $5,000 means in the real currency of the Gulf fishermen's realm, namely, you know, shrimp, fish, oysters,
right,
that kind of thing.
No, I'm just saying, you know, they're not to be trusted, and I don't trust the government either. I don't think we're being told exactly what's going down. But unfortunately for the government and BP and then ultimately us, they ain't going to be able to hide this shit for long. You can't have that much oil coming out. I don't even know how to wrap my head around it, Bob. I don't know.
Nor do I. And let me take this opportunity, Sandra, to say, A, I'm not cutting the Obama administration any slack. But I've alluded to it earlier in the program, and I want to be clear on this. Do you remember, because you are a voracious reader, do you remember when Seymour Hersh wrote that article toward the end of the Bush administration, talking about how Dick Cheney had planted, what was the term they used? I can't remember. Not spies, but like sleeper cells, way deep inside the civil service of the government.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember that article and several other pieces I've read talking about the bureaucracy and the state of it with these horrible Republicans deep inside. Yeah.
Yeah, as compared to Bill Clinton allegedly taking the W's off the keyboards, this is much more nefarious.
Oh, please. That turned out to be a lie anyway.
Right, it was.
Yeah.
But this isn't. Dick Cheney buried operatives inside the government way deep. Now, Who is the government? What is the government bureaucracy that is charged with dealing with these platforms? It is suddenly we're finding out it is the MMS.
Yeah, right.
The something mineral and mineral service.
Yeah, it's out of the Department of Interior, the same ones who were having sex.
Yeah, and right, they were having sex with oil executives. They were going to parties. They were right. And that's what I meant earlier when I said that our real politic does not track in true time in real time with what happens in government. It's a year and a half into the Obama administration, but how many of these moles, and that was the word, moles, how many of these moles are in the MMS at the behest of Dick Cheney? How many decisions were made by MMS with Dick Cheney's guidance? Because, you know, when you're running around and you're partying and popping the cork and popping this and popping that with the oil industry, frankly, that is Bush. I mean, that is classic Bush administration conduct.
No, and then the thing that kills me the most about this is that the total disconnect with the public. First, you're told that government's bad. Hate the government. Then these horrible things happen, and you get the wide-eyed Americans. Oh, how can this happen? And it's just like, dudes, you know, put it together. You know, we want things to work. You know how government that works best is invisible, right? When it's working good, you ain't thinking about it because
right.
It's working.
Yeah.
But it ain't working, and this is what's happened. And then I get questions in my class about, oh, you know, how could this happen in America? Type of common, you know, narrative, and it just breaks my heart at this point because, you know, I don't even know how to even begin to explain to people the steps that we've taken to get here. You know?
Because it takes more than you can do in a 50-minute class session.
Well, and also, you know, I'm not even in a position to be doing it. You know, we can't. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. But I just sort of, I don't know why people are expecting anything other than what's going on. I guess that's the end point I want to make. It's shocking what's happened. But it shouldn't be, if you know what's going on.
No, if you're paying attention, this is all working according to script.
But unfortunately for us, though, and I don't even know because I'm not an engineer, you know, I'm not an environmentalist, any of that, but I'm really concerned that they won't be able to contain this oil. And I know enough that a dead ocean spells a big problem for the rest of us, right?
Especially in light of, you know, Kate mentioned it in an email, especially in light of where the Gulf Stream goes.
Well, it has all these loops and whatnot, right?
Well, but it winds up warming the coast of the UK.
Right, okay.
And parts of Northern Europe.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm saying so. But what kills me, though, is that we need to have a government that's going to tell us what's going on. And, you know, I fear that we don't, even in the face of this calamity. If they, you know, with this 50,000 barrel business, that's a long way from 5,000, Bob.
A big long way.
And so if we can't even get an, you know what I mean? What do they expect to gain by not being up front with something like this? I have to say I'm confused.
At this point, it's a race against time, Sandra.
So they're hoping they can somehow
they want to drill that so-called relief well and get that thing going. And because it is a critical situation, they hope to cut all the corners that they asked to cut and get that thing producing and get that oil back into the profit stream. Never mind the Gulf Stream. It's about the profit stream.
No, and I love how in the U.S., I mean, it seems like the level of urgency, like with jobs or lack of and anything else that's important, is really low-key. You know, I'm about sick of hearing about this bomb that didn't happen, Bob.
Oh, I'm fit to scream.
I'm like about done with that. And also, hello, what the fuck is going on in Nashville? That should be on 24/7. I'm sorry, that's horrible. And the waters are going to run to the Gulf and destroy what little fishing there is left.
Right, because we do know, of course, that the world's fisheries are overfished. Without the oil spills, we are over-consuming the fisheries of the world.
No, but, I mean, apparently the waters are going to empty out in the Gulf, too. So the people who fish in New Orleans, I mean, in Louisiana, can look forward to getting hit from the north as well as the Gulf, from what I've been reading. I mean, it just sounds horrific.
Hate to use the phrase, but I think there's a perfect storm involved here somewhere.
Well, anyway, and it's just, I don't know, I'm really sort of, as you can tell, I'm a bit gobsmacked and really overwhelmed by the shit that's going down. Because it seems really out of control yet again. And can I top it off by saying we got some sort of one-time audit Fed happening. At the same time, these bitches didn't pass the two, you know, stop the too big to fail thing. So what do you think the public's going to do when they see trillions of money going to these banks and the Democrats had a chance to break up the banks?
It almost betrays a level of political ineptitude that one is scarcely capable of comprehending. I mean, the chess masters have left the board.
No, do you understand what I'm saying? No, it's like, wait.
Yes.
You know, they don't seem to understand that the too big to fail is something that every goddamn American understands. This ain't nothing deep. Everybody can see that this is some BS. So, if you show them that there's trillions going here, there, and everywhere quite clearly, and you didn't do something about it when you had a chance, come on.
I know. And God almighty. And yet, as I'm driving down, I don't do early mornings very often, Sandra, but we had the trip down to Charleston today for the knighting ceremony for my son and all that stuff that I talked about. And driving down... yeah, it was pretty cool. But driving down, I was listening to NPR.
Oh, yes.
And the business with what was with the shenanigans that were played with the financial reform bill, it was described, I kid you not, this is a quote. Republicans and liberals came together to defeat that amendment. Really? Republicans and liberals? Not Republicans and Democrats?
To defeat the Kaufman Amendment?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Republicans and liberals. And liberals.
No. Wow.
And by the way, just to sort of reinforce stuff, I encourage people to wander down my Facebook page, okay? There's a link there. To just a hero of the environmental movement. The man, he is the Hurricane Creek Keeper out of Alabama. He's been on this program a number of times. His name is John Waffen. And John, through the good offices of a magnificent organization called South Wings, got in an airplane and did what the for-profit media will not do. Sandra, he flew all over the Gulf looking at the slick and videoing it. And John just sent me a note via Facebook saying, this thing is bigger than anyone is telling.
Right, okay. I'm just permanently skeptical. I don't believe it. I just think that this is just something from hell. And it's just based on the idea that they've hit a reserve that's apparently just huge. So where's it going to go but into the ocean now, right?
Yeah, I mean.
And so is this video someplace where it can be viewed or what?
Yeah, there's a link to it on my Facebook page.
Oh, okay, got you.
I don't know if you're Facebooked or not, but.
I'm kind of odd that way.
Well, no, I hate it, but it's a necessary evil in my world.
I'm not in, I'm not interested. interested in OnStar, Facebook, all that kind of gives me the heebies.
Well, it doesn't do me any good either. I tell you what, it is there, but John has linked it elsewhere. I just can't get to it right now. Hang on. He started a blog over this. Let me just, what I'll do is, after the show, I will go and find the link and I'll shoot it to you so you can just go straight to John's blog.
Yeah, I would like, I'm just sort of.
Cause see, one of the fascinating things that John mentions in here is that the airspace is restricted now. You cannot. Yeah, you cannot fly lower than 3,000 feet over the slick.
So what's the reason for that?
My guess is that if you start flying 500 feet over the slick or some such, or 1,000 feet, you're liable to see the profundity of it that you can't get from higher altitudes.
Well, no, but what are those photos that they're showing from NOAA?
Yeah. Isn't that satellite photography?
Oh, okay. And so you're saying that what your friend's doing, what gives you a more realistic.
Yeah, I mean it's right there in front of your face. It was shot with a video camera held in a hand.
Oh, okay.
And it hasn't been through any significant digital processing or image resolution or any of the stuff that has to happen to get a picture from a satellite onto your computer.
Well, no, but I mean, this article about the amount of oil is like in a Christian Science Monitor. It's not like it's some deep dark blog from.
It's not. And by the way, to get there, Sandra and everybody else, John's blog is at bpoilslick.blogspot.com, and the post is Southwing's flight over BP Slick. bpoilslick.blogspot.com, and thanks to Marty out in California for grabbing that on the fly. So, you know, it amazes me that people like John Wathen have to get in airplanes. And, of course, John is the same guy who was the first man to report the real horror of the Kingston coal ash disaster a year ago last Christmas.
The Tennessee Valley thing?
Yeah, and not to compare, but everybody, and I'm not being hard on anybody, Sandra, but I want to point something out. We're talking here about maybe it's, 10 times, 5 times, 20 times, whatever is coming out of this well as what BP has said. Okay? It would have to be orders of magnitude higher, as in 1,000 times more, to begin to even approach the level of horror and output of the Kingston disaster. 4 billion gallons of toxic coal waste that broke out of that impoundment and ruined the natural waters of East Tennessee. And they're still ruined, Sandra.
Well, that's what I was about to ask you. Of course, this shit is just left as is, like Katrina, like, the unemployment rate in the black community. You know what I mean? This stuff ain't going away.
No.
And that's what is starting to get to me about this country, is that people just turn away, and it's just piling up, piling and piling and piling. Then I look online, I look at what them folks in Greece are doing. They're like, we may be going down, but...
We're going down swinging. And did you notice that was the first place that Wall Street tried to go before their computer glitch came out? Tried to blame it on the Greeks.
Oh, yeah. No. Listen, that shit in Wall Street... No, that's just all gangster at this point. You're going to have a 1,000-point drop, and, like, what in the world? It's just stunning to me. I don't even know what to think of it, except it's also, it's just toxic. You can just use that across
the board. And it piles up. Whether it's the Kingston coal ash disaster or the Gulf or the Upper Big Branch disaster, or, you know, just tick them off on your fingers, Sandra. Katrina. Keep going. The flooding that plagues and is never reported upon in the Great Northwest in Washington State that our friend Cindy has written about periodically. All of these things pile up, and just like we were talking about history existing on an ever-flowing continuum that doesn't have real hard breaks in it, so too these don't. They pile up and they tax the ability of a people to deal with them.
Yeah, well,
and frankly, whether we like to admit it or not, Grover Norquist's dream of making the government so weak that you can drown it in a bathtub is still an operative philosophy for a great number of the people in this country.
No, to me, it's already come to pass, because if you have a government that's going to defer to an oil industry to regulate itself, that tells me all I need to know. You're going to tell me you're going to turn over the country's heritage to these predators and not even regulate them? Please, Jesus, that's it, you know?
Right, the symptoms. You know, any good physician, Sandra, will tell you that it's easy to spot symptoms, but aggregating the symptoms and coming up with a differential diagnosis of the disease is a manifestly more difficult thing. And in this instance, I know this sounds crazy, but in this instance, you have to do a differential diagnosis of the disease afflicting this country that includes symptoms like the Gulf of Mexico. Big symptom. Like the Kingston ash spill. Big symptom. Considerably smaller, but locally more horrible, the Upper Big Branch disaster. But you know what? You will not come up with an appropriate diagnosis if you don't also include the predatory things going on Wall Street and the fact that Colorado Springs can't take out its trash and mow its garbage anymore, and add into it the fact that Nashville is still underwater.
Right. Bingo. I mean, that's it. You draw a nasty, ugly, connect the dots just right there. And it's just incredible.
And you know, the other corollary, and I was emailing with our buddy Tosh about this the other day, the other corollary, and I mentioned it on the show as well, is no one ever retreats from empire. No one ever says, yeah, we tried the empire thing, I think we'll go back to being a republic. Nobody does that.
No.
And empires are, by definition, and you know this far better than I do, given your training and your education and expertise, empires are self-consuming. And so when you put all of that together, you realize that we've entered a phase, and I don't care how much Glenn Beck cries on air about how we need to get back to the Constitution because I love America. The fact of the matter is, Sandra, we ain't. All right? An empire climbs or dies. And that's where we are. And what it boils down to is when you get into that position, you will periodically have great leaders come along. But they are as often as not, as Eugene Finnerman over at Finnerman Works can tell us, they are as often as not followed by idiots or preceded by them. Look at Marcus Aurelius. You know, we started this conversation talking about ancient history. Look at Marcus Aurelius. He took the shambles that the Roman Empire was in by the time he got it, and because he had been taught meticulously and assiduously how to rule, he pulled some of the pieces back together and made it look like stuff was working again.
Mm-hmm.
But he had no sooner done it than he was dead, and it started falling apart again.
Exactly.
Now, anybody who thinks that the same thing is not playing out in a United States of America that has a visionary like FDR, followed by a decent caretaker like Harry Truman, followed by a laissez-faire Republican like Eisenhower, and a brief moment of uplift that is dashed to the earth in John Kennedy, that is followed by Richard Nixon, that is followed by Gerald Ford, that has another little uptick of hope in Jimmy Carter, that is again dashed to the earth with Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, that upticks again for a moment with Bill Clinton, who got the bills paid despite all of his other shortcomings, which he now acknowledges. And then with every uptick, and I think we're approaching almost the level of a political corollary or theorem or something here, Sandra, with every tiny uptick, there is an inversely hyper-proportional downslide, which is represented, of course, after Bill Clinton, by George W. Bush.
And at the same time, you know, in a macro sense, you know, we're plagued with this sort of ever-increasing power of the executive, which is completely detrimental to us. Let's be honest. It's low education, low information, people needing some daddy figure, turning the presidency into a nightmare in this country. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't care.
And so,
I don't care who the hell it is. The presidency as it's constituted now is a scary...
scary, scary thing. And it's look, again, with the classical history, again, with why don't we teach this in schools anymore? But the executive, whether he be called imperator or president, concentrates power to the point that any legislative body becomes a caricature of itself and little more than a debating society. And so what we know is that if Barack Obama does not get reelected in 2012, what follows him, if my theorem is correct, is a person who is 10 times worse than Barack Obama was good. For all of those out there who want to goon on Barack Obama and say that he's a fascist tool or that he is just another corporocrat or whatever, and I've done it, okay? But I'm also a realist, and you've been hard on him, Sandra.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, right now, on this scale, he's as good as it gets.
Yeah, oh no.
And what comes after him on the other end of the spectrum is 10 times worse.
Right, but he is not doing himself any favors, though, by not taking advantage of this overblown presidency.
Right, and that's... he's not. He's... You know, some of the stuff that drives us crazy is the fact that he will behave in Bushian fashion if it comes to illegal wiretapping or torture. He'll behave in Bushian fashion, and he'll send out his attorneys general to defend the National Day of Prayer in Wisconsin, for Christ's sakes. But he won't behave in Bushian fashion and saying, this, by God, is what I want. This is what we need.
Right.
This is how we're going to fix it. And I don't give a rat's rear end what you miserable right-wing little thugs think about it. This needs fixing. Get me the hammer. Get me the nails.
No, the constant sort of trying to balance everything is, you know, my head's about to explode. I mean, for example, when there was some interview he gave when he was talking about the Supreme Court, just sort of vilifying the Warren Court and all the court, the black court, all the courts that provided us with,
safeguards against fascism?
Right. And he's trying to, you know, make this sort of equal. It's disgusting. I'm so over it with him.
You know, I'm going to be, absolutely, and I got to throw in this little smart-ass comment, Sandra. With everything that the Repiglicans have done and everything that we're focused on in the Gulf, and with Freedom Fries and Freedom Toast going before us, how long is it before some right-winger looks up and says, why in the hell are we calling that the Gulf of Mexico? That's like calling it the Gulf of Illegal Aliens. I think we need to rename it on the map Gulf of Merca. How long? Come on.
Like in the vein of Freedom Fries?
Yeah. Gulf of America.
Well, listen, I'll let you go, but the only other thing I wanted to throw in there was, you know, you're talking about the situation with the state. Well, I heard something really disturbing to me. Merkel, you know, the chancellor of Germany,
yeah,
basically saying, we're at war with the market. And that just sort of just reverberates in my mind. I'm like, okay, wait a minute. these markets were what you guys got together. But I thought that it really epitomizes what's going on.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, I heard the other day that, frankly, the trouble in Greece would not be the trouble in Greece if they hadn't just said goodbye drachma.
Well, no, there's that. I mean, but also what's really disturbing, though, is Germany and France, they need to cut a check for their own damn banks and not expect it to be sorted out on the backs of these Greek workers, which is what's going on, which is not going to end well because the France is real quiet on this because they know that their banks need to be bailed out by hook or crook, and they're going to screw them people over to do it.
You know, if you ever have a cup of coffee in law school, Sandra, they will tell you on day one that there are three rules governing the practice of law. And those three rules are as follows. Get the money up front. Get the money up front. And law three, get the money up front. And that's what's happening. You know, this is, you know, the EU is going to take it out of Greece's ass.
Right, but the thing is, it ain't working. I don't know if you've noticed, but the other foreign capitals around the world now, they're starting to freak out. So whatever the Eurozone is thinking they're doing, you know, everyone's scared now of contagion. You know that.
And Britain is suddenly looking pretty doggone prescient for hanging onto the pound, aren't they?
Oh, especially since they're gonna probably have to take a 20% devaluation. But hey, they can. And nations. States rule again. All right, enough with the globalization business, Bob. I'm telling you.
Maybe some good can be pulled out of this, because while we're talking about the sort of microcosmic sort of evolutionary failings of the United States moving into empire, you know, we're not the world. We like to think we are, but we ain't.
Yeah, well, and you know, and I hate to go real technical, but the sort of hegemonic stability theory is that you need a hegemon to hold shit together. Well, what do you think is happening to the hegemon right now?
Hegemon
having a problem.
Houston, we have a problem. We have a hegemonic problem. Yeah.
But anyway, listen, I don't know, there's so much to talk about, and I really have to ask you, what's up with LT?
Oh. What went into his head?
Oh, he's effed up anyway, but I was like, damn, dude.
Yeah, well, the fact of the matter is, LT may not have realized that the day of his sports glories are far over, and you know, he may not even have the lawyer money at this point.
I don't know, but that's the, you know, it's an ugly, ugly, ugly thing.
I got one. Okay, if we're going to do this real quick before you go, I got one to throw at you.
Okay.
While we're talking about baseball players boycotting the 2011 All-Star Game in Phoenix,
yeah,
why are we not talking about demanding that the NCAA pull the football mythical national championship from Phoenix in January of 2011, a scant 7 months from now?
Oh, I didn't hear about that. Are you kidding?
No, I'm not.
I didn't know they were playing that there. Oh, yeah, that's, why aren't they talking about that? Why, what do you think?
Because...
Too much money to do it, huh?
Right. I mean, you know, who watches the All-Star game anymore? Come on.
Well, exactly. No, I agree with you on that one.
You know, so we can do that as a sort of a token, but get out there and really F with the money? Mm-mm.
Well, we'll see about that.
But the funny thing is, the NCAA ought to find this to be a no-brainer, because remember... when the NFL said, oh, yeah, gosh, yeah, or the networks actually said, yeah, we'll be happy to play Tim and Pam Tebow talking about his miraculous Jesus-like birth. The NFL, you know, they said that. The NCAA at the same time said, no, Mrs. Tebow, no, thank you. We don't want your ads about what a miracle little Timmy was. We'll pass.
We're able to figure that one out, but not this one?
Apparently.
We'll see. That'd be interesting to follow, you know. You would think people calling for boycotts would have been all over that by now. Huh?
Well, either I'm dead wrong or the national championship was played in New Orleans last year, remember? Crimson Tide running up and down the field.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't in Pasadena. No, okay. What was in Pasadena?
Rose Bowl.
Okay, yeah, you know.
See, it rotates Pasadena, or maybe it was Pasadena. Well, anyway, how quickly we forget. It wasn't in Phoenix.
I thought they were talking about all them people from Alabama going to California. I just remember.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, it was. Yeah, that's right. It was Pasadena. But it rotates basically Miami, New Orleans, Pasadena, Phoenix, because the original contractors to the whole mythical national championship were the Orange Bowl, the Sugar Bowl, the Fiesta Bowl, and the Rose Bowl. So, if I understand correctly, Sandra, it rotates back around to Phoenix in January 2011.
Well, and the only way that something's going to happen is to really hit them economically. You're right about that. And the sports angle is a good one.
You know, what it boils down to is the Phoenix Suns can wear their Los Suns jerseys, and I'm not downplaying that in any sense because I'm proud of them for it. And we can talk about baseball and the All-Star game because there's a bunch of Latino players, I hate that term, in Major League Baseball. We apparently don't have enough college players named Ramirez, Gutierrez, Alvarez, and et cetera for those young scholarship athletes to stand up and say, well, you know what? We may go to the national championship, but if we go, we're going without me.
Well, no, but if we're going to be creating a lot of Sun Cities in the United States again, you know, these little issues will pop up, you know?
Well, I would love to see people begin to put some heat on the NCAA.
Yeah, no, you know, I'll look into that too, you know, because, you know, I like my sport, so I got to check that out. That's a good one. Anyway, Bob, yes, I know we meandered all over the place here, but...
But it was a dandy, Sandra.
Yeah. Okay, take care.
All right, bye now. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Sandra calling from California, and you know what? It looks like it's one of those nights where we just go merrily through the phone calls. Okay, no. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening. I have been summoned.
You have been. David, what's up?
Well, I wanted to bring your attention to a story that fits in quite nicely, but it's going to upset you at the same time.
Oh, dear.
It's going to upset you quite a bit.
Oh, no.
This happened yesterday, and it deals with law. On Thursday, Judge Louis A. Kaplan of the United States District Court in Manhattan said that Joe Berlinger, the director of Crude, would have to turn over more than 600 hours of footage from his documentary. The film chronicles the Ecuadorians who sued Texaco, now owned by Chevron, saying an oil field contaminated their water. Chevron said that Mr. Berlinger's footage could be helpful as it seeks to have the litigation dismissed and pursues an international treaty arbitration related to the lawsuit. And then Michael Moore commented on it. If this isn't overturned, it would make a lot of documentary filmmakers afraid. People are going to have to start getting rid of all their extra footage now, right?
Yeah, no more Crude, no more The Cove, no more Food Incorporated. I saw this story, David. And in a way, maybe we add in with that list that I pulled together while talking with Sandra about all the little symptoms of a sick country. You got to throw in a judicial system where judges issue rulings like this. And a judicial system where the people issue rulings like Citizens United. This is spooky. This is the absolute chilling of free speech.
Yeah. Michael Moore goes on to say the chilling effect of this is someone like me. If something like this is upheld, the next whistleblower, the next corporation is going to think twice about showing me some documents.
David, I'll go a step further with you. It does something else too.
Yeah.
Because these, you know, even if you're making a documentary, there is art involved, okay? And there is a message being given. There is a story being told.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is Chevron gets its hands on the extra footage, because you'll notice it's about the extra footage. These idiots could go out and for probably $10 or less pick up Crude and figure out all they need to know.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason they're asking for the extra footage, David, is because they're looking, and what they've done is they've gone on an indirect fishing expedition. Instead of suing Berlinger directly, they have used other litigation as a means to get back in underneath him and get his extra footage so that they can then turn around and make some sort of cockamamie claim that he deliberately distorted the footage and that thereby he libeled the person that is Chevron Corporation and is liable for damages. This does far more than what Michael Moore said, David.
This doesn't just chill people from giving up
sensitive information. This is designed by Chevron to shut the whole process down. And if they're successful, you can look for Massey Energy to be dropping a lawsuit on a handful of brilliant filmmakers who have documented what they have done here in Appalachia in an effort. Because, again, it's one of those right-wing versus left-wing things. The right wing cannot play, David, on a level playing field. They can only get in the game if the dice are loaded, if there's a break on the roulette wheel, and the deck is stacked and marked.
Yeah, and the other thing is that if they do overturn this, I don't think Chevron's going to care that much because they just gave an example of how easy they could just step in and say, yeah, we're going to subpoena your footage. Oh, you're going to overturn it? Okay, we'll go back to court for this one. And they'll keep doing it until they get that ruling where they want it.
Yeah. So, this is, no, I'm glad you brought the story up because it's very, very real.
But to end on a positive note, because I read this story and I thought this was pretty amazing, but have you heard of this woman named Sheila Radzidowicz?
No.
Well, she's a, it says in the article, I was not supposed to live. Then I wasn't ever supposed to walk. Because of a congenital birth defect, she was born without arms. She also came into the world without kneecaps and with her feet rotated and toward each other. She endured multiple surgeries as a young girl, all aimed at helping her walk until she was in junior high. Today, Radowitz is not only walking, she is kicking. And next month, she will test for her black belt in Taekwondo. I grew up with the phrase, the impossible only takes a little longer. And then it goes into how her parents raised her, and the video is amazing. Because the fact is they show her holding nunchucks, even though she doesn't have hands. And it's like looking at the impossible. Looks like looking at the impossible become possible, right there. I mean, she will get her black belt with people. And I guess what I'm saying is there's an example of an inspiring story for you. If you're having a bad day, or your family's going through something.
We need those. We absolutely do, and that's the power of individual determination, and
I'm not saying it's a miracle.
No, you're not. No, it is decidedly not a miracle.
Yeah, if it was a miracle, they would just.
If it was a miracle, she would have been born a black belt without arms. There wouldn't.
Right.
If it was a miracle, there wouldn't have needed to have been any surgeries. But this but at the same, I take it this woman is American?
Yes.
Yeah, see, in the world that the Repiglicans live in, David, she doesn't exist. Because for all of their prattling about American exceptionalism, America can't do anything anymore. We've got hundreds of thousands of gallons, if not millions of gallons now, of crude oil spilling into the Gulf of Mexico that stands to wreck the entire Gulf Coast of the United States. But, you know, that's because we're too damn dumb to build grid 2.0 and start working away from a filthy fossil fuel future. We're too dumb for that because that's what the Republicans say. Well, you know, we can't do that. You know, the country that gave the world the Marshall Plan, that gave the world the Berlin airlift, we can't do that anymore because we are a beaten-down people, according to the Republican Party. And yet a woman like this stands out there and does it. And she does it, I'm sure, with familial support and love and the dedication of her sensei and her dojo.
Well, you know, the other thing is they would turn it around if this story was posted on right-wing news stories. They would say, see that? she took personal responsibility, not even looking.
She didn't need no nanny state. But the fact of the matter is, Hillary Clinton was right. It does take a village, David. It does take a village. And her village is her family, her community around her, and those who support her and train her and root for her and give her the grounding with which she can achieve that personal milestone. You know, there's no such thing in human culture, there is no such thing as a lone wolf. All those idiot right-wingers out there who say, I believe in rugged individualism, there's not a one of them could live as a rugged individual. And in fact, the fact that we call it a rugged individual means that it has no polish.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And one other thing I wanted to mention was... I mentioned this as a humorous because I've actually been watching a few episodes of this this History Channel series, and it's really making my mind go, I can't believe they get away with this. I really can't.
See, I haven't had the... Are you talking about the story of America or whatever it is?
No. I'm talking about something even more. You know, it's like you just have to... It leaves you a little bit puzzled. Like, they intentionally want to mislead people in a new way. I don't know if have you seen this show called Ancient Astronauts?
No.
It's a series.
Don't do this to me, David. Don't do this to me.
It's a series on extraterrestrials being with us in throughout helping us throughout history. And the experts that they get are people that you would leave to the bookshelf.
Oh, I'm sure. Is Eric Von Daniken still alive?
Yes. Yes, they got him.
Is he in some sort of the Stephen Hawking chair now, but he's still sitting there beeping away like Captain Pike about the ancient astronauts? Jesus.
they have him and they have George Norrie as an expert.
Oh, God.
You know what's crazy?
Just stop it.
No. Here's the crazy thing. They'll bring on a rational person? I can't believe the History Channel. They've completely gone over into the...
They have.
...into the new world.
David. You are the horn pop culture icon. Let's get this right. The History Channel has jumped the shark.
Oh, I know. I'm with you completely, but what I'm saying is they'll rationalize it in a weird way. They'll have a narrator. they won't be saying facts. The narrator says constantly, and what if those aliens were traveling in space in...
Yes, it's documentary filmmaking with the Fox style manual transposed on top of it. Some people say aliens built the massive stone walls of Tiahuanaco in Bolivia.
But the great thing about it, see, another thing they're doing is they're completely downgrading science and facts. And this is why I told people, this is why I'm telling this to people. I'm telling you, you are witnessing the decimation of science before your very own eyes with the most majority of the American public. And I'll give you an example of how that is real quickly. They will have an MIT scientist on this program. They will talk to him for 1 minute. But what they will do is, you know how a NOVA program revolves around facts? Well, on Ancient Astronauts, they don't do that. They'll take a scientist and he'll say one thing, but before he gets into this is not possible and that's not possible, they'll just have him say that one phrase, and they'll go right back to George Norrie and Dan.
Right, and the next thing you know, they've got the aliens landing and delivering frisbees, wheat Chex, and human civilization.
That's right.
See, I saw one on Sunday.
That
it was on the History Channel, and I went running into the other room where Grandma Agnes was looking after the babies, and I said, "Come here, you got to see this. Come here." And she came in and sat down, and as she listened to some of the narration, her jaw just dropped. Couldn't believe it. Because
Ancient Astronauts?
No, this wasn't Ancient Astronauts.
Oh, man, you're missing out.
No, this was worse.
Uh-huh.
This was a relatively modern piece, apparently. I'm seeing in the chat room that maybe the Ancient Astronauts thing's been around a little while. But no, this was a piece, and I love, you know how I love Mesoamerican and Central American and South American and North American prehistory.
Right.
I'm fascinated with those peoples and what they accomplished before they were rubbed out or whatever. And this was a thing where the guy, the so-called archaeologist involved, posited that the Mayans took boats to an island 3 days voyage by motor off the coast of Chile. And that there they built a monument that just happens to align with an eclipse of the sun that will happen in December 2012, according to the Mayan doomsday prophecies. Oh, we're all dead. And it went on, and it talked about how the Mayans populated North America. They did everything but claim that they were Mormons. And the thing is, there was no archaeology involved because, you know, Mayan archaeology is plenty fascinating. For instance, to use your Nova analogy, you can go over to PBS and there's a brilliant documentary over there about how they finally figured out what Mayan writing is and what it says.
Mm-hmm.
And that story in itself is just mind-boggling in its complexity and its twists and turns, and oh, it's amazing. But instead of focus on that, no, they pulled a couple of names off of a couple of glyphs at Palenque. One was Pakal, and Pakal was the longest ruling ruler of any society on planet Earth ever.
Right.
And then he had a son named Khanbalam. And so, without any data, without any evidence, they simply claim that Khanbalam got on a boat and sailed to this island in the Pacific off of the Chilean coast, where he built a monument of a sun god and a jaguar behind it. And, you know, there's lots of footage of him in the boat and talking about, oh, and then the Mayan doomsday prophecy and yada, 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 yada.
Yeah.
And then they get on the island and lots of footage of them hiking up there. And then they get to what they have repeatedly referred to as the monument, David.
Yeah.
And the monument's a rock. And they use some CGI to show you how, if you look at it from this angle, well, by Jove, it's the Lord Aha. And the jaguar behind him. And I just sat there staring at him. I don't see no jaguar. And I don't see no tiki neither.
Yeah.
But they go on at it as if it is fact. And we've got to move fast so that we can raise funds for further exploration of this amazing discovery in Mayan archaeology before 2012, when it may just be too late.
You know, that's one of the things that the Ancient Astronauts Program, and I know someone brought it up that this is nothing new. No, that's not what I mean. What I mean by this being new is they're actually going to have a series, season one, season two, season three. It's really clever what they do, though. They just go all over the place, and they just constantly re-edit, and they show constantly the same interviews, and they snip and cut so many times. You have amnesia, and you don't even realize that what you're watching, you watched in the 90-minute special that they did last year. But the crazy thing about it is when you were talking about Pakal, they love doing this. They'll have an archaeologist on, and this archaeologist will sound like he's going to make a succinct, insightful point.
Based on evidence.
He goes off the deep end, and he says, well, you know, Pakal, as an emperor, if you look on his tomb, he's flying in a spaceship.
Yes!
So he's got to be an alien.
Look at his nose!
Yeah, he's got to be.
That's a spaceship. That's a helmet on his head.
And then they'll cut to Eric Donakin, and then he'll be like, now you ought to understand. You sound just like Werner Herzog. I feel bad for Werner Herzog. You sound just like,
Jesus, David.
People don't know anything about science.
But see, that's what it makes me crazy, because people really don't know anything about science. You know, if you've got a little smattering of understanding of the nature of archaeology, you're done with this thing, and you're watching it purely for the comedic value for the other 58 minutes. But if you don't, if you've been dumbed down by a school system that specializes in dumbing down, then you sit there and say, well, goddamn, I guess it's all over in 2012. Eunice, pack the bags.
I tell you what, they're going to have 12 episodes a year on the ancient astronauts. I guarantee they won't go less than 4 seasons. That's my bet.
What are we going to do on Christmas Day 2012? When the world is still here?
No, see, that's the brilliant thing about it that people don't catch on. What the pseudoscientists peddle is they say it's an elevation of consciousness. I could say that at any time. But immediately when you start selling that, it's an elevation of consciousness in 2012. I can feel the energy field. The vortex is coming in. It's like that stuff in Sedona. It's like what they do in Sedona.
Roswell. Roswell. Area 51.
Yeah, Roswell, too.
Pascagoula.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, it was Eric Von Daniken that first started the Pascagoula hustle.
He's a genius hustler, man.
He's a loony. Yeah. Hey, David, I got to roll. We're running out of program, and I still got a bunch of calls to hit. Thanks, man.
All right, later. Bye.
Later. Bye now. I'm glad David brought that up because crap makes me nuts. And I got to back up in the email and offer some thanks. Brand new email in from a new listener. Website is eBartaldes. That's eBartaldes. eBartaldes.wordpress.com. He introduces himself to me as a freelance journalist, and among other things, points to me and wrote to me and says, thanks for your Tim James piece. You remember Tim James Speaks English over on YouTube, put together by the inimitable Matt Osborne of Osborne Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. Well, you can see it again and even comment on it over at eBartaldes, eBartaldes, .wordpress.com. And it went on, Ernest did, went on to say, with regard to our discussion of New Orleans, I feel sorry for the Crescent City. First Katrina and the cold shoulder from the nation, and now a spill. What's left? A bunch of co-eds getting drunk on Bourbon Street? It's shameful. Elaine writes in and says, it occurred to me about 4 or 5 a.m. this morning as if my depression, fear, and anger aren't already enough at this point. I've been speaking to two friends, one a molecular biologist and one my cousin's husband, a geophysicist formerly with Exxon. Both live in Texas. Both are saying this is going to be a worldwide disaster of proportions never before seen, and the disbursement chemicals are making it even worse. I was brought up in Northwest Florida with weekly visits to the coast most of my life. My parents visited the shore, my 85-year-old dad's home away from home, for the last time last weekend. Early this morning, I couldn't sleep, began writing for a while. This thought came to me, and I posted it on Facebook. What is there to stop these murderous companies? To stop their further drilling once they've already killed all the flora, fauna, and unfortunately humans? What do they do then? What do they then have that will stop them? And the Christian lunatics prepare for their trip in their chariots pulled by white Jesus and white horses. Says Elaine, Shiva Om. I know. And by the way, in case you didn't know, just further evidence, newly announced and much ballyhooed, Massey Energy has opened a branch office in Switzerland. Somebody check the extradition treaties, would you please? Then again, maybe Don can go over there with a few million in a money belt. God knows he's got the girth for the big-ass money belt enough to carry it. And just put it in a numbered Swiss bank account before the litigants from Upper Big Branch can get to it. Sleazy bastards. Sleazy bastards. Let's roll on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Hey,
am I too loud? Am I too soft?
No, you're doing great. Is this Ange?
Yes.
Cool. How are you?
I have been through a lot in the last 3 months, and I really don't want to talk about it now because we don't have much time. But then over 2012, it got me going when you were talking to, what is it, Luke, about the Antarctica thing. And it got reminded me of the At the Mountains of Madness, one of my favorite stories, and got me thinking of Terrence McKenna. And I always have this weird theory that's been working up, and it's not a theory. It's more like just a wild idea. But it's like, what if, okay, I don't know if you remember this, but Terrence McKenna worked out some kind of computer program that was ancient algorithms from somewhere in Asia that predicted, like, the past and predicted the future along the Mayan calendar. Have you ever seen that?
I'm familiar with what you're describing. Yes.
Okay, and he said that in 2012 it might not be the end of the world. It might be some sort of continuum in time that, you know, off the charts, like with all the other stuff in the past and that's happened according to that. And, you know, it could be maybe we travel through time. Maybe we find, I mean, you know, we could find
something
out there. We could travel through time. And what if, okay, everybody on this world has been through this again? And in 2012, I don't think this is going to happen. This is a wild theory. What if in 2012 we all go back to the past? And it's like we keep...
But see, the people...
Like,
Ange, the people...
We're trying to go back
Ange.
To people from the past when the world ends, starts from the beginning where there's no one.
But Ange, Ange, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hold on just a minute, please. The problem with that is that you know, things like what McKenna said aren't theories. They are imaginings. Theories are grounded in scientific observation.
Oh, I know. Okay, all right. They're not. This is just my imagination flowing. I'm an artist and kind of.
No. And I'm not downplaying it. That has a beautiful place. In the human experience. But I think what David was pointing out and what I'm pointing out is when you take it out and you hustle it to a credulous public as science, science itself is harmed.
See, I don't know. I don't think Terrence McKenna was doing that. Just like, you know, when all the writers in science fiction, they're not trying to make it a theory.
No, but what you see, on the History Channel is
George Orwell, you know, 1984, and some of the other science fiction writers.
But what's on the History Channel is being hustled as science. That's the point. You know, the thing that I saw about Khan Balam was not presented as speculative fiction, like science fiction is, like Dune or something. It was presented as real, hard science that was the product of the scientific method and scientific investigation.
They do that all the time. This lady was talking about the show on Animal Planet called Lost Tapes. And, oh, all these real tapes, and this has really happened. They found these tapes. And she was describing one, and then that night I went home and found it. And then I found out that IMD profile of the actress that played in it. And it's like, and when you watch it, you know, it's like she went on to three. Yeah. And, yeah, they do that all the time. And these people believe it. But I'm just saying, I'm just kind of being wild and going out there. It's like, you know, you really wonder, because when you look at all the stuff that's been foretold and is kind of, you know, can be predicted has happened, it makes you wonder if people from the past actually came from the future. Like that movie Repo Man. I mean, I am just...
Well, you know one of my favorite films in the world is Idiocracy.
Oh, yeah, I love that, too. I love that film.
But I don't love it because it's about time travel. I love it because it is a commentary that is placed in the speculative realm of time travel that is actually a profound commentary on the state of our culture today.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about real facts. It's like, one never knows what's going to happen. And it's like all these people that are into the money and corruption and everything else, it's like it's being relived over and over again. I mean, you know, there was a time when the Earth had nothing. It just makes me wonder if it somehow is some kind of time continuum and we keep going over and over and over again. Because when there's nobody here, as far as humans are concerned, the Earth will eventually replenish itself. And then where did all those other people come from? I don't know. It's just a far out thing, you know, and it makes me think maybe when will this happen? You know what I mean? It's just like the story in my head that, you know, sometimes when things get too much.
Oh, I know.
It's like Sandra said, your head wants to explode. You try to be creative and try to make...
Well, yeah, and you know, I did watch the first episode of the Stephen Hawking thing on the Discovery Channel, and he raised the issue of time travel, but he did so in such a way as to do it within not speculative fiction, but speculative science, which is a completely different critter. You know, I said earlier in talking with Jim, that, you know, I consider alternate realities. And the fact of the matter is, you know, the human experience, religion, gods, everything was born out of dreaming and hallucinating. It's a fact. It just was. By peoples whose cognitive skills were not well enough to develop to really be able to tell the difference between reality and unreality. Now, with that having been said, you know, there are theories of physics out there that now posit not only alternate realities, but alternate universes, as if the universes themselves, Ange, are like pages in a book in which one page can touch another page, but the two pages are utterly different from one another, save for the fact that they're both pages. Now, with that in mind, you know, I'm a very, very vivid dreamer. Okay.
I am too. I
dream. I dream in full Technicolor 3D glory.
Like Wizard of Oz stuff.
Yeah, I do. I wake up with stuff that I can't even explain in terms of my subconscious having picked up a word or a phrase. I dream stuff that. Oh well, I'm gonna get myself in trouble. I dream stuff that a few years later I look up and go, oh my God, I dreamed that. Okay. I can't explain it. All I can do is quote Shakespeare. There is more in heaven and earth than are dreamt of than your philosophies, Horatio, or whatever it was he said. There's stuff we can't explain. But yeah, right. I mean, for all I know, my dreams are wanderings over into another universe.
Yes.
But the difference is, I'm not putting it out as scientific fact on the Discovery Channel or on the History Channel.
But you have to wonder, it's like, you know, where did all these people come up with all these ideas? It was maybe it's because they were from the future but now live in the past because something is rewound the whole thing. It's like maybe we just keep rewinding and rewinding till we get it right. You know, like Groundhog's Day. It's like we go a billion years and then it ends and then we go back again and it's like we're trying to get it right, but who knows if we'll ever get it right. It may be just a vicious cycle. I mean, just like life. It's all a cycle. I don't. It's just my crazy mind.
No, nothing crazy about it.
Kind of, you know, throwing something different out there.
And it's fun to speculate on. The problem though comes when we pass it off to a credulous public as fact.
Yeah. See, I don't do that. I'm just, you know, this is me. I'm just going out there with my crazy little thoughts. But you know, I will stand up. My head feels like it's going to explode sometimes. And as far as, you know, these people out there, and I deal with them all the time. Some of them are good people, but they believe everything that is not right. And when you're trying to tell them the truth, they la-la-la you. And I literally had a lady la-la-la me and hold her ears.
Not surprised.
And that's how they are. They don't want to know anything. They don't want to know anything that's going to bring them down or say something against what they've been told, you know? And I don't know if they're ever going to change. They're not going to change until it's been slapped in their face, until it's too late, is what's going to happen. And, you know, there's nothing you can do.
And you know what?
It's sad. It makes me want to cry.
I suppose there are some people who will be very disappointed to wake up on December the 24th, 2012, because they expected so much more. But you know what the Mayan calendar is brilliant.
People are going to go crazy and max out their credit cards and even make the world worse. You know, it's what's going to happen. Just start doing dumb stuff. And
well, anybody who's ever seen the movie Contact, you know, there's that scene where once the alien communication has been announced, all the freaks come running out from behind the baseboards, Ange. And, you know, there's people there, come, Lord, aliens. And then there's an evangelical Christian saying, we got to tell the aliens about Jeebus. And, I mean, they're all there. And you know what? It is absolutely, and the book is so much better than the movie. But that scene in the movie is spot on. Hey, Angela, I'm going to try to get one more phone call in. Good talking to you, dear. Have a wonderful weekend. Shoot me an email sometime. I hope everything's okay.
I will. Okay.
All right. Bye now.
Love you guys. Bye.
Bye. Calling from Arkansas, that is Ange. And one more call, and I'm sorry for the other five that I'm not going to get to.
Hey, Bob, it's Richard.
Hey, Richard, what's up? You got 2 minutes.
Okay, I'm your Campbell Soup correspondent.
Yes, indeed. The man who ruined tomato soup for me.
At forever, right?
Yeah, haven't bought a can since.
You're going to have to make your own, Bob. Yeah, let's see. My stack has to be very much shortened. First of all, you mentioned something about Ben and Jerry's having, what was it in it?
Oh, guar gum, locust bean gum, yeah.
High fructose corn. Ben and Jerry's was sold to Unilever about 2 years ago.
Well, there you go.
So it's Lever Brothers guy. Let's see, other thing. Oh, yeah, Dave in up in Eureka. There's an alternate feed for him, which you probably have forgotten about, but it's over on the White Rose site.
Oh, you mean the 12K stream?
There's a 12K, and there's a 16K, and there's a 48K.
No, we've got one that's even lower. I think we've got a 12K stream.
No, but my point is that this is an alternate way of his getting on, which doesn't require the higher tech of your new website, which I can't use, by the way. I can't.
Well, it's understand. Still under construction, so.
Okay, well, whatever. I just can't get into it. So, well, let's see. Your clock's running, and my other issues will take a little too long, so I guess I should give up.
Well, darn. Then let's try next week.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we will.
I will be back on Wednesday. I'm out of town Monday and Tuesday.
Gotcha.
All right, thanks, Richard.
Okay, happy wrap-up.
All right, thanks. Bye now.
Yeah.
Well, all right, then, okay. That, then, is it. With a minute to spare. Thanks, everybody, for what was, although an odd week, a great week. Thank you very, very, very much. thanks to those of you who help keep all of this going. Sincerely, thank you. We are, of course, in our April fundraising drive. Someday, somehow, we're going to be able to skip a month because we just, the lottery, whatever. I hit the lottery, we skip all the months. But we do need your help. We always do. It's a fact. I'm sorry. But we do. PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, as is the snail mail address under the tab called Contribute. And thank you to all of you who make this possible, not for us just to do, but for other people who can't contribute to be able to listen as well, to be able to listen live or anytime they wish or podcast. Thank you. Thanks go out, as ever, to the whole crew, to John Fox, who's still working on the website, to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, our blogger, Texas Betsy, Lottie in the chat room. Thanks to Matt Osborne, our Southeast correspondent at Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. Thanks to my head writer, David, in Tennessee. Thanks to the hardworking, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. Remember, no shows Monday or Tuesday, back Wednesday. Till then, I hope you have a great weekend. And we will talk, I hope, soon. And always, 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 Gina, Bob's a moron and pressed the wrong button. No, Gina, it's all for you.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy!
Come on, baby! Come on,
Friday afternoons in what should be mid-spring here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia, when Agnes had to do everything short of chasing me into the studio with a ball bat. It's exquisite here. It is beautiful here. It is hot and the sun is warm and wonderful. Oh, it's going to be, it may be a struggle to keep my hand out of the icebox and away from that cold bottle of Corona. But we'll get through. Yes, we will, because it is the end of the working week. For me, it is, well, it's sort of a grieving day because that means I've got 2 days of enforced silence before we talk again. No, oh my God, I'm on the road next week. We will not talk again until Wednesday evening. I have meetings I have to attend down in Kentucky on Monday and Tuesday, but we'll be back on Wednesday. So it was necessary that I absolutely be here this evening because this has been a squirreled up week as it was. No show on Monday, technical difficulties on Wednesday. So that gives us Tuesday and Thursday together, and we had to round out the week with this Friday on the front porch on the horn. I am, of course, Bob Kincaid. And it is. It's beautiful here. I know, talking about the weather on the radio. Someday I'll learn. But, you know, this is one of those days that was made for that little-known poem by Robert Frost where he says, "Oh, stormy, stormy world, the days in which you were not swirled in mist and cloud are so very few. I cannot wonder whence I get the lasting sense of so much warmth and light. It may be altogether from one day's perfect weather when starting clear at dawn, the day swept clearly on to finish clear at eve." A poem entitled, "Happiness Makes Up in Height for What It Lacks in Length." And this is a beautiful day, and it was a touching day. Agnes and I got up at 5 a.m. That's probably why I sound like I have gargled razor blades. Just been up too long, too little fluids, hot, 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 hot. And yeah, my sinuses have been concreted in with pollen. Somebody turned me upside down earlier in the day and just poured pollen in my sinuses, and it's like, so my apologies for that. But yeah, it's beautiful. It is exquisite here. And it was beautiful in Charleston today, too. I only got in behind the microphone a matter of minutes ago, having sort of kept up the news with the news by browsing on my cell phone all day long. We have a new addition to that very select group of West Virginians known as Knights and Ladies of the Golden Horseshoe. Now, that may seem sound silly and insignificant to people far, far away from the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia. But in this state, it's significant. It is the oldest, the Golden Horseshoe Test is the oldest test of geographic, historical, and cultural knowledge of one's native state of any such in the country. Now, having been begun back in 1929 or 1931 or so, and based upon based upon an expedition, a merry expedition, mind you, mounted. Now, doggone it, if I see what you people have done to my mind. You make me have to think dirty so that I can keep up with the dirty thoughts that Virginia Governor George Spotswood mounted an expedition out of the Piedmont area of Virginia, or whatever they call it over there in the old Dominion, and across the Blue Ridge looking for settlement possibilities, in other words, Indian land to steal. And they had a right good old time doing it in 1716. And when they returned, Governor Spotswood, Colonial Governor Spotswood, rewarded each of the 50 participants in that expedition with a golden horseshoe to memorialize the event. And, of course, where he was headed, where he explored ultimately, was within the territorial confines of what we now know as West Virginia. And so the award given for passing that test is the Golden Horseshoe Award and membership in that merry band. There are the